JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 10, cover dated May 1993. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but guess what? I have brought along a friend. In fact, each episode, I invite a guest host to help me tackle an issue of the JSA. Now, every superhero has their origin story, right? But so do our guests. I first encountered today's co-host not in a secret lair or on the battlefields of Earth 2, but in the comments section of another of my previous podcasts. And since then, he's become a regular presence here in this show's comment section, and I have been fortunate enough to share a few meals with him face-to-face. So I guess now I'm obligated to call him a friend? But don't let our familiarity fool you. He is still a bit of an outsider. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Tim Price. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Tim. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Hey, thank you, Shaq. I'm glad to be here. I'm doing all right. But why are all the furniture being put away and tarps being put on the paintings and stuff? What, it's like the place is shutting down? What's going on over
yeah,
here?
Yeah, don't mind all the bubble wrap. Yes, we are in fact covering the last issue in this volume of JSA, right? The 10-issue run, it was supposed to be, well, it was an ongoing series, but issue 10, it got canceled, as we all know. But here's the good news. Yes, we're packing up this particular volume of Justice Society of America. However, we have still got tons of more 1990s content. This is not the end of JSA in the 90s at all. We've got several spotlight episodes to do. Plus, we are going to begin very soon the 1991 Justice Society of America 8-issue miniseries. Yes, I did them out of order. We did the 1992 series first. Now we're doing 1991 just because I wanted to do this one first. Anyway, it's an 8-issue miniseries. Same writer, Len Strzuski. Plus, some of the issues are drawn by Mike Parabek, so this is all sounding very familiar. It should be.
It does sound a tad familiar.
Yes. But then we're going to get other issues drawn by Rick Burchett, Grant Meum, Tom Artis, and all the covers are going to be by Tom Lyle, so we have tons of great stuff ahead. So, while we may be packing up this particular issue, there is more ahead. Don't you worry. Now, folks, at the top of this, I did describe Tim as a friend. That was a bit of a gamble, because if you're listening to this on the day of release, Tim and I were actually just together yesterday, hanging out in person at the Baltimore Comic Con.
Was that yesterday?
It was. I know. Because of the timey-wimey-ness, obviously, that is in Tim and I's future. And I'm banking on the fact that we'll still be friends by the end of that weekend. If not, this is a bit of like a snuff film, I guess, or sort of a sort, I suppose.
Well, a lot of things happen at Comic Cons, and so, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Don't say it that way.
Well, whatever happens at Comic Con stays at Comic Con. So I'm going to trust that we'll still be friends.
Okay. I hope so. Okay. I can guarantee there's going to be ice cream. That's all I can promise. I know that.
Well, that's all it takes.
Yes. Anyone who's ever hung out with me in person knows that there will be ice cream, so that's perfectly fine.
And I am really looking forward to the Baltimore Comic Con. It's going to be you and me and like 50 of our closest podcast friends. It's going to be madhouse. It's going to be a madhouse of podcasts.
Insane number of podcasting buddies. It's going to be incredible. We're going to have a fantastic time. But before we spend too much time talking about conventions, we should thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly describe from the InStock Trades library, and usually it's tied into that month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or fashion. This time, I picked DC Finest Events, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Trade Paperback, Volume 1. Now, this is the same trade that my guest last month picked, but I'm picking it again. First of all, it's amazing. Second of all, I'm picking it for a different reason. I'm picking it because today, as we said, we're looking at the last issue of Justice Society of America. Well, this collection includes a storyline that was billed as the last JLA Justice Society team-up from JLA 244 and Infinity Inc. number 19. So I thought that'd be kind of a fun sort of connection. So what this collection is, again, it's DC Finest Events, Crisis on Infinite Earths Trade Paperback. They have collected Crisis along along with all the tie-in issues, and they are releasing it in one compendium, or what's going to be probably four volumes or something, but or three volumes. But either way, they're putting them in reading order. So like you're going to read, I don't know, an issue of Crisis number one, and then an issue of JLA or DC Comics Presents or whatever order they determine you're supposed to read this whole thing in from front to back. So you're not reading Crisis 1 through 12, you're reading Crisis 1 and then something else. It's pretty cool. There's a million comics in here, okay? You get Crisis on Infinite Earths 1 through 4, you get the JLA story, you get Infinity Inc. story, DC Comics Presents, All-Star Squadron, Firestorm, Detective Comics, Green Lantern, Batman, Loser Special, Wonder Woman, Swamp Thing, lots of stuff. A million different writers and artists from the 1980s. Obviously, lots of George Perez in there. It's 544 pages, which is insane.
Wow.
What's even more insane is the price. It's only $39.99. But jeez, because it's in stock trades, it'll be 40% off. So it's going to be $23.99. When Tim and I are recording this in the long lost past, this volume hasn't come out yet, but it is scheduled for release before the episode drops. So this should be on your shelves right now, folks. DC Finest Events, Crisis on Infinite Earths Trade Paperback Volume 1. So looks so good.
Now, the best part to me about this particular choice is that reading order part. That is such a thing that you can't usually get from a collected volume like this, or even approaching the monthly stop by the comic book shop that you normally get. Because when you can read them right in order of the issues in the collections, like, of course, that's how you're going to read them. But to put them in reading order in the collection itself, oh, that's such a nice touch. I love it.
I love it. Like, you know, because Crisis was the first big DC crossover in this fashion. You know, by the time they get to Legends, I think they label them across the top, like part 11, part 12, I think, if I remember correctly. So here it was just like, yeah, I don't know what order to read this thing in. So unless the footnote told you what to read it in. So yeah, I think it's absolutely cool. So Tim, did you happen to bring a selection to discuss?
Well, I thought that since all the cool kids did it, I better do it myself because it's my only chance to be one of the cool kids.
All the cool kids and Michael Bailey. That's right.
And Michael Bailey? Oh,
yeah, he did it too.
Oh, man. Now the pressure's on. Well, and I don't know if this one has been picked before, but, you know, as this is the last issue of this run of JSA, you know, who's going to care? So what I've brought this time is the Batman Adventures Omnibus hardcover.
Woohoo!
Now, this massive omnibus collects the entire comics run of the animated Dark Knight from the Batman Adventures 1 to 36, Adventures Annual 1 and 2, Adventures Holiday Special number 1, a story from Batman Black and White, the Batman Adventures Mad Love number 1, one of my all-time favorite comics ever is that issue, and a never-before-printed comic book, I guess reprinted comic book adaptation of Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
How has that never been reprinted?
I didn't even know that it existed.
Oh, okay.
That's amazing. Oh, yeah. I mean, you would think that thing would be reprinted up the wazoo, as the kids say.
But the kids.
So this is a great collection here. And now it's got a bunch of writers like Paul Dini, Kelly Puckett, Martin Pascoe, artists galore, including Bruce Timm, Ty Templeton, and Mike Parobek.
Woo!
So that's the hook that I've got for bringing this as a recommendation. The cover artist is Ty Templeton, and so you know it's a good cover. Now, this hardcover has 1,192 pages.
Oh my gosh.
Forget it's stopping a bullet. This puppy can stop a grenade.
You probably need a forklift to carry it, too.
My goodness. Yeah, I'm going to have to go see my chiropractor before I buy mine. So, now, its original price is $150, but from in-stock trades, you can get it for $90. You save 40% on this monster. So, it just sounds fantastic, and I can't wait to get one.
That's amazing. Hell of a deal. Great stories. More Mike Parobek. Everyone loves the Batman cartoon. Everyone loves the Batman Adventures comic. So it's a win all the way around. It's a great pick. Mm-hmm. Well done. Well done, Tim.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In a certain tiers, you get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks go out to this all-star squadron of supporters: Alex Osias, Al the Comics Guy, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Etchison, Mike Zemkowski, Roger Preeb, Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, and Ted Kelvington. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast.
Wait. Hold on.
What?
Shag.
What?
I think there's another name on your list.
I'm not seeing one.
I think there's a name. Put your glasses on and look and zoom. Zoom in. Okay. It's down there at the bottom.
Look, man. All right. Off the air. Yeah. Obviously, your credit card cleared for the Patreon, but your wife was mailing me a monthly check to be your friend, and I haven't got one in like 3 months. So.
Look. If it's there, if Patreon's got the credit card, I the name's got to be said. I mean, that's you're legally bound.
Okay.
It's a legal contract in today's society. This is all that holds us back from madness and chaos.
Okay, folks. Thank you to all our Patreons and some guy named Tim Price.
Woohoo!
All right, moving on to more important things. All right, enough of that.
Nothing more important than getting your name read on the air.
Well, folks, as we always say, we want you to be part of the conversation, because it is always about building an online community of JSA fans around the show. Obviously, we want you to go and leave comments on our website, but you can also find us on social media as JSA Presents on Facebook, Twitter, or X, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. And by the way, folks, I want to say Fire and Water Podcast Network is now on Instagram. So please give us a follow and like some of our posts and stories over there because you got to feed that almighty algorithm. Come hit us up on the gram, as the kids say. And by kids, I mean no one. So anyway.
You mean the Instagrammas?
My daughter's just embarrassed I'm on there and that I follow her. But anyway. now, Tim, this is your moment. This is what you've been waiting for since you came to me as this young little child and said, "Dear Mr. Shag, I'd like to be on one of your podcasts one day." And I said, "Sure."
Wow,
and then
that impression is uncanny.
It is. I know.
So as in completely wrong.
Well, the true story, folks, is he really did. He came to me and said, "I'd love to be on your show someday. I've never been on a podcast." And I said, "Sure, you can be on my show." And before I even had him on the show, he went and started joined a podcast network, whatever. So, anyway, Tim, this is your chance. Please tell us your origin story with the JSA. How'd you find the team? What made you fall in love with them? Or is this the first time you've ever heard of them?
Amazingly, with me sending feedback to every single episode that you've done, I actually have heard of them before.
Oh, good.
Just in passing. Well, so when I was a wee lad.
Oh, gosh. This is going to take a while.
But my parents would buy like Treasury editions or comic book 3-packs and stuff for trips before I was actively reading or actively collecting. And one of the things we got was this Justice League of America Treasury edition, which has this amazing cover on the front with the JLA flying out from the center. And, you know, like 8 of them all coming out. Well, on the back cover of that Treasury, they have another image titled The Original Justice Society of America. And it looks almost the same as the front cover, just changing which characters are there. And we have the whole JSA, 8 members on that in the back. And they even helpfully at the bottom had a little text to say who each of these characters were. So it's like, oh, Dr. Fate. Don't know who that is. What, a different Green Lantern? What, a different Flash? Who's Dr. Midnight? And it was fascinating to them for them to include that in that the JSA does not appear in the stories at all inside the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't think so, unless you have some other information. But
No. Even though we have an entire show based on treasuries on our network, I just don't have much experience with them. And if it's Rob Kelly talking, I don't tend to listen. So I don't actually know the contents of this treasury.
That is fine. They're all Silver Age stories of the JLA from the 60s and like the early 60s. So it's like before we got to Denny O'Neill and other people kind of sprucing them up and bringing them more modern storytelling. But yeah, the JSA just on this back image. So it's fascinating, first off, that they included that. And having the text to tell you who the characters were was super helpful to me. And without even having seen a story with them, I intuited just because of this that, oh, it's like an another version of the League. It's just other heroes with the same names. Wow, that's fascinating. It did not make me go, what is going on here? No, I was just like intrigued and was able to just accept that as who these must be. So that was my first time of seeing them. Knew nothing else about them besides this image, but just the seed was planted. And I'd even seen some of these other characters on other things, like in some Christmas Treasury, I think they had a center section with some Christmas covers, like little small ones. And they had like Comics Cavalcade covers with Wonder Woman, but also had the Golden Age Flash and Green Lantern on all those. They always did things together, the three of them.
Okay.
They holiday together, shall we say. So I was like, oh, wow, there they are again. So just kind of like making me aware of them. Just it's like, oh, okay, yeah, they're really part of history here. So, you know, but still by these times, I wasn't collecting comics on my own, not new comics yet. I would read other kids' comics sometimes. You know, like sometimes they gave me permission. Sometimes I just did it.
Okay.
where I managed to read the second part of that Death of Mr. Terrific story.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Because my first one was the first part, and I didn't read the second part for like 20 years. If we had been friends when we were kids, we would have got a complete story.
That is, this describes comic book collecting from the spinner rack era to a T, doesn't it?
Right.
No two people read the same two issues.
Exactly.
But I also know I saw some other JLA, JSA team up where I think the god Mercury popped up and helped the society fly a car into space. I really don't know what it was. If any listeners know which story that was, or Shag, if you happen to know, I'm not presuming. I'm just not, I don't want to put you on the spot. Just not presuming. Help me out, because I don't know what story that was anymore.
No, I read all the JLA, JSA team-ups at some point in my life and retained none of them. Like, okay. Until you get to when Firestorm joins the team, then I committed all those suckers to memory for the most part. Before that, though, unfortunately, it's very foggy.
I understand. Well, we all need an external hard drive for things like that.
Right.
Well, after that, I was starting to get into my own collecting, and I was big into Infinity Incorporated for a long time. And I also picked up that Last Days of JSA from the Crisis, because I picked up almost everything that was Crisis related back at the time.
Sure.
I have a problem. I admit it. I have a problem.
I was that guy for Legends. Don't worry.
Yeah. Well, but then came the 8-issue miniseries, which predates this series. And I enjoyed that a lot. It was really fun. I was enjoying the characters and the story that we had. It just kind of came together. It hit some of the right buttons. I just was having a good old time. And then this series hit. And yeah, this is what hooked me on the JSA. Because as original Golden Age heroes, they were interesting. And I could appreciate them. But seeing them as elder statesman superheroes is what really I latched onto and made them sing for me. It made them different from their younger counterparts. It didn't just make them alternate versions. They were their own people because they were the older heroes. And they approached things differently and had a different perspective on things. And this series has a lot of them acting like, I've seen this all before. You're not going to surprise me. And I can handle the situation. Something about that really worked for me. So yeah, this was in my 20s, and I just appreciated their different point of view. And then also this series really kind of continued what we'd seen in All-Star Comics with Power Girl, of getting a mix of the older veteran heroes with some younger heroes for contrast. I like that, and that's just only become a bigger thing in the years since. And that's what keeps me coming back to the JSA, is seeing the veteran heroes and the rookies and making things work and learning from each other. They kind of learn from each other along the way. But yeah, that's where I came from. And that's where I love the JSA.
You summed it up beautifully. The elder statesman aspect, the mentorship of the next generation, a lot of it starts here. And it's beautiful. And that's what keeps me with the JSA as well. Yeah, and I agree completely, because, you know, sometimes when you see the JSA in the 40s and times like that, it just feels like they're missing that, right? They're missing the aspect. Like, maybe that's why the Earth 2 series didn't work for me. I don't know. But seeing them as young guys, again, has an appeal, like All-Star Squadron, but it works better better for me as the elder statesman and the mentorship. Really does.
Right. And that's where I enjoyed the 8-issue miniseries,
mm-hmm.
but I loved this ongoing series.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
It was nice and kind of fun to see this as a time capsule piece, as a period piece from them when they were younger heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, yeah, we have younger heroes nowadays in the modern era.
Yep.
And I guess I really do prefer seeing them as older heroes now. I've seen other people who really want the JSA to be doing period pieces all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand wanting that, but that's not what I want. I want Green Lantern and Flash, Alan and Jay saying, well, here we go again. And just taking guys down.
And their friendship, you know, the friendship yes. that comes from being together for so long. And yeah, I love it. I love the seeing the period stuff in short bursts. Like, I'm looking forward to the JSA year one. I enjoyed the same in miniseries that took place back in the era. So I love it. Or like you said, the 8 issues, we knew from start to finish it was only going to be 8 issues. So it's nice to see a compartmentalized story back in the past. I know, like you said, a lot of people, especially even in the comment section of the show, are advocating for a World War II era JSA book. And I would read it, obviously, but I, again, mm-hmm. I like old people, so, because I am one myself. Anyway.
Yes. I do have some thoughts on that as well as we go along.
All right, so every episode, we try to have some little fun discussion topic, and I'm taking us on a bit of a sidestep this time, because usually it's about the JSA, is what we do. However, we're not going to do this one specifically about JSA. What we're going to talk about, since this is the last issue of this volume of Justice Society America, we thought a fun topic might be to name some of our favorite comic book last issues. Doesn't have to be JSA related. So again, I know this isn't a JSA themed discussion topic. Come on, we're all comic book readers here, so you've got some too. So Tim and I are going to share some of our favorite last issues of different comics. I want to hear your thoughts on this in the comment section. Let us know some of your favorite last issues of a comic. And the parameters I was assuming going in would be, we're talking about, you know, an ongoing series, and whether it ended organically or ended, you know, was canceled, whatever, but it's some ongoing series that had a final issue. Not necessarily a miniseries, not necessarily the last issue in someone's run, but if we fudge a little bit, maybe we will. I don't know. Let's see where we go. You want to go back and forth a little bit?
Yeah, let's go back and forth.
All right, you go first.
Okay, well, let me start with, honestly, probably my favorite comic book series, period.
Okay.
Which is the independently produced Jeff Smith's Bone.
Oh.
I love this story. And being a dyed-in-the-wool superhero fan like I am, it is amazing to me that one of my favorite series is a fantasy sword and sorcery story. But it is. With funny characters. With funny cartoon characters. Which is the hook. You know, that's the hook. But I love this series so much. And it's one of the things that's tricky about endings, because, you know, a book being canceled is one kind of ending where you're kind of like forced on them. But then there's the long form storytelling where the writer really does have an ending in mind from the very beginning of when they start. They're just not necessarily set on it's going to be issue number X. They're just when is it going to happen when they get there organically as they produce the series? Well, Jeff Smith's Bone ends on issue number 55. And the fact alone that it has a cover image of one of his great characters, the Great Red Dragon, on the center of it, and his head just filling up the entire space, is a glorious image. And the story has been a beautiful arc of coming of age, finding yourself, and saving the world, as you do.
Sure.
But then it has the friends have to depart. You know, Bone has to leave the girl that he's basically fallen in love with, but she's not really in love with him, but she loves him, if we can see the difference. He is her best friend, mm-hmm. and he wants her to stay, but he can't. He has to go back home. And the departure, the two of them, breaks my heart every time, and I just adore it. I've read the series from beginning to end more than once with my kids when they were little,
mm-hmm.
because they asked me to.
Aww.
And the last issue, I'll do some of the funny voices as I go along, and I have to not cry, because it really gets me each time. So it's a beautiful ending to me, one of the masterpieces of long-form storytelling in comics. But so what one do you have? What do you want to start with?
That's a fantastic pick. I've never actually read Bone, but like everybody else on Earth has. Like I'm the mistake here. Like so it's not Bone, it's me. My stepson, growing up, he read Bone. He loved it. He just was over the moon for Bone. So I'm the default there. So I need to seek that out eventually. So one of my picks, and I did not go back and reread these in advance of this. So my discussion of these will probably be a lot shorter. A lot of it's just instinctual. They bring make me happy. But the first one is a great one. It's Starman issue number 80. You know, this is James Robinson's, you know, opus of the story of Jack Knight, and the final issue that he probably had in mind from very early on, based on the fortune telling and all this stuff that was going on in the early issues, tells the full ending of Jack Knight. It tells the ending of Jack Knight's story, so much so that DC let him end that character story. He didn't kill the character. He just rode off to the sunset, essentially. And other than one or two panel cameos, he hasn't been seen since. And that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing that DC would let go of a property that was selling that well and let James Robinson end it that well. And it was a beautiful series. And Jack Knight's always been one of my favorite characters. I'm looking at an action figure of him right in here next to my desk. And I've got various pieces of memorabilia about the character. And I loved it. Issue 80 was great. And I was so worried that, you know, a year later, there'd be a new Jack Knight series written by, you know, writer X. And they never did that. And I think it makes it that much more precious.
Oh, yeah, that's a great pick, because that series spoke to a lot of people. Honestly, I fell out in the middle, but it was more because of finances than of enjoyment of the series. But it's right there on my list of, I got to get on my reread list to get through it from beginning to end. I need some real good time to pull the trigger, and I'm looking forward to it. But I did read the final arcs when it came out. So yeah, that's a great pick.
And sometimes you fall out of comics, and that's okay. And Starman, like every other comic, had its better issues than others, you know, and better swings. And sometimes it was maybe written too much for the trade or whatever. So it does work well in a binging situation. So what you got next?
Okay, well, this probably was on my mind because you discussed the series recently on this very podcast, but I thought of the final issue of The Spectre from 1998, issue number 62.
Ooh.
Which, again, was another series that really felt like it had this ending in mind from the very beginning. Just wasn't necessarily written in stone exactly when it would happen. And I don't really know if that series was canceled or if they just decided to end it. I'm not sure either way.
They were told the series was going to end by DC, and DC gave them a year advance notice. So
nice. Okay.
They were given the opportunity to close out the story they wanted, which is phenomenal. So I guess maybe sales were flagging or whatever, but DC did say, yeah, we're going to end the series. You got a year. So I don't know if you call that a cancellation, really. I mean, I don't know. It's... Anyway.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It works both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a soft cancellation, shall we say. A kinder, gentler cancellation.
Certainly kinder than JSA got, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that series just came to an end, and what it really was laying to rest Jim Corrigan and letting him have peace after being the spirit of vengeance for decades, and just letting him find his heaven, whatever that meant to him. Oh, just a beautiful ending. I do appreciate that one so much.
That's a fantastic pick. And Jim Corr, that series, you know, Ostringer and Mandrake was amazing. You know, we waxed its car for a long time on that episode. So great pick. Wonderful. My next pick, honestly, I don't even remember the details of this issue. It lives in my heart large. And so I had to pick it. It's Battlestar Galactica, number 23, published by Marvel Comics. It came out in 1980, the end of 1980, and it's written and drawn by Walt Simonson, so you know it's amazing, inked by Klaus Janson. And this was the first issue of Battlestar Galactica I ever picked up. I just randomly got it from the convenience store or something. I don't even know why. Maybe it was the amazing cover. It's got a fantastic cover where Starbuck and Apollo are back-to-back, and they've got their guns out. And behind them is their friend Jolly, who, by the way, is just a normal human, just like them. However, Walt Simonson has drawn him like he's from, you know, Asgard. He's huge. He's as big as the Juggernaut or something.
And there is a Volstagian quality to him.
Exactly. And he's got, like, his head is shaved, and he's just got, like, this long-haired ponytail. But Jolly was just a regular guy on the show, which is funny. Anyway, and it's the layout of the cover is amazing, with this hard yellow border around the characters, and it says, bring on the pirates. But the thing, one of the things I always love, though, on the cover, it says, last issue, a collector's item. I've never heard of a last issue declared a collector's item. First issue, maybe.
Oh, no.
Last issue, no. But anyway, it was. I read the comic. I read it. I don't remember what it's about now, but I read it and read it and read it and loved it. The cover probably fell off. I read it so many times, and it just brings me joy, so I had to throw it on the list. And it's Walt Simonson. Come on.
Oh, yeah. How can you go wrong with that? I did not think I read any of the Battlestar Galactica, and I barely remember the TV series. I probably saw it like once or twice, but you can't go wrong with a Walt Simonson on the artwork.
Don't remember the series, huh? Of the TV show. Well, this has been fun. I am going to see if I can find someone else to help me cover JSA number 10. Thanks for coming, Tim. I appreciate it.
I didn't say I didn't like it. It's only like, I don't remember.
It's only like 17 episodes. Go find it on streaming, for goodness sakes. What's your next stupid comic, Tim?
Oh, fine. Well, let's see. I think we'll go from something like that to switching gears to a miniseries that was very near and dear to my heart, which was 1983's Hawkeye miniseries. And yeah, it is tough with endings. Like, honestly, when books get canceled, a lot of times they don't stick the landing on that last issue. It really can be feel rushed or awkward. And sometimes I'm off the book before it gets to the last issue. So I don't, it's so funny how many times I think I might have dropped the book before I got to the last issue. So it's hard for me to say which ones are good final ones. But when we get to miniseries, it's much easier. Mm-hmm. And on that last issue of Hawkeye, issue number 4, it's like we've been building that relationship with him and Mockingbird, even to the point where the final issue on the inside says Stanley presents Hawkeye and Mockingbird.
Aww.
Not just Hawkeye, Hawkeye and Mockingbird in that final one. And, you know, they've had been forced to fight each other to the death, but Hawkeye pulls through, saves them both, but he's made himself deaf in the process. And he's walking away and doesn't know that Mockingbird is trying to move their relationship up a level. He doesn't even realize it. But off panel, she chases him down. And next thing we know, they're in a hotel honeymoon suite in the heart-shaped hot tub. And I love that ending.
Okay.
Is it cheesy? Of course it is. But, you know, teenage Tim loved cheesy. Adult Tim still loves cheesy. And it just was a really heartwarming way to something we don't see happen with superheroes. So them really making a true connection and trying to make something of it, as opposed to just Kirk and putting on the boots and see you later.
Right, right.
So it's a sweet ending for a far too short miniseries.
That's great. I don't think I've ever read that miniseries. And I think my friends all loved it. And so I went chasing after West Coast Avengers when it started because I felt like, well, this is the mm-hmm. next, you know, evolution to that, which made me a big West Coast Avengers fan. So I'm going to have to check that series out. And I didn't realize that's the story where he goes deaf. I knew his hearing got damaged. I just never knew where it actually happened. So, all right, good to know.
Yeah, that's exactly where it happened.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, since Tim just cheated, by the way, by using a miniseries rather than a series that's canceled, I guess Tim doesn't understand the rules that I didn't actually bother to tell him in advance. I'll give you.
Thank you. That's the best kind of correct.
I'll technically correct. I'll do a quick few cheats myself. I'm not going to dwell on them. But so there's three comics that came to mind that I wanted to pick. I wasn't going to till again Tim egregiously cheated. Which is three books where a long run ended. So it wasn't the end of the series, but that creative team ended. Animal Man number 24, Grant Morrison's final issue. Holy crap! Amazing comic. Just wow. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read Animal Man, it's all worth it. Justice League America number 60, the end of the Giffen DeMatteis era. Amazing comic, wrapping up 5 years of amazing stories. Just incredible. And then Dr. Fate number 24, J.M. DeMatteis and Sean McManus's one. That comic made me bawl. It made me rethink my religious beliefs. I wrote in letters to him. I've interviewed J.M. DeMatteis on several podcasts, and he was kind enough to talk to me off the air about Dr. Fate number 24 and that story and what it meant to me, and just was really mm-hmm. special to get to share that with him. So, all right, those are my cheats. Those don't really count. I'm not going to dwell on them. But then my last one, I'm going to pick a double pick. I actually didn't do this on purpose, but then I realized the comics I picked. So how beautiful is this to end on a tribute to this very podcast network? I have picked the last issue of Aquaman and the last issue of Firestorm. And I swear I did not mean to do that. If you don't know, folks, the Fire and Water Podcast Network began as the Aquaman and Firestorm podcast called Fire and Water. And Aquaman number 56 from 1971, written by Steve Skates, art by Jim Aparo. It's got this amazing like creature coming up out of Lake Michigan, and or Lake Erie, I can't remember, one of the Great Lakes, and it's getting ready to attack Detroit. And it actually says, "The creature that devoured Detroit." And when I was younger, probably late high school, a friend of mine was a Legion of Superheroes collector, and I just thought that was cool. He collected back issues, and that was his mission, to collect all the back issues. So I decided I liked Aquaman because I had read him in several things, and I decided one day, like, I'm going to be an Aquaman collector. That's what I'm going to do now. And so I went through the back issues, and I saw this cover, and I'm like, oh, damn. This is where I start. This is the first issue I buy as a back issue collector of Aquaman, not knowing it was the last issue. And I, to this day, I still love this comic. We've talked about it on the network, I think twice. We loved it so much. Anyway, great issue. Aquaman 56.
I'm looking at the cover, by the way. It's a glorious cover.
It's amazing.
My goodness. That is so great.
It's by Nick Carty. So, I mean, of course it's good.
Oh, yeah.
But the creature who's like, just that line, the creature that devoured Detroit, you know, has there ever been a bigger concern than that?
Well, that's why they needed a Justice League there, apparently.
Oh, man. You know. I love Justice League Detroit, so I'm gonna let that crack go. So,
I love Detroit Justice League tons. What are you talking about?
Nice man, Howell. Then my pick, next one, was Firestorm number 100, which was the end of the Fury of Firestorm line. By this point, he's the Elemental. He fights Brimstone from Legends in the sun. The story returned Ronnie Raymond to us because he had been trapped inside the Elemental. Professor Martin Stein becomes the Elemental. There's a lot of beautiful moments. There's some moments in the issue that are kind of cheesy, but it's huge. It's 64 pages, so you get a lot of stuff out of there. In the end, Ronnie and Lorraine, which is Firestorm and Firehawk, you know, get to be together as Professor flies through the cosmos as Firestorm. It's a great issue. So yeah, my ending is Aquaman and Firestorm. So there we go.
Those are all great picks. And I'm sure that the people who are writing in comments to this episode will note that even though my miniseries might have been a cheat, it still was a final issue of a series, and all of Shag's cheats were not the final issues of the actual series. I'm sure there'll be plenty of feedback on that very point.
Baiting the audience. Thank you. Or leading the witness. There we go.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, folks,
I'm just stating facts here.
As Tim has reminded you, please go to fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post. We want to hear your favorite last issues of various comics. And, you know, maybe some of yours are JSA. I mean, we threw some JSA things out there with Spectre and Starman and stuff like that. But we want to hear whatever you've got. So share that, please, in the comments. All right. Now, we need to get in and talk about this comic. I guess maybe I've been dragging my feet because I didn't want it to end. But we need to do this. We're going to talk about Justice Society of America number 10, cover dated May 1993, on the shelves August 6th, 1993. Now, folks, we are going to post some images from this issue on our gallery post, which again, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Look for the gallery post for this issue. You'll see some of the pages that are out there. Not going to do every page, obviously, because you can read it on DC Infinite. You can buy the floppy. They're collecting it if you're over in the UK. So check that out. Now, the cover price was $1.25, 5 shiny quarters. The cover, one more time, by Mike Paraback and Mike Macklin. It's a beauty. Why don't you describe it for us, Tim?
I'd be glad to, and very, very sad to describe the last cover of the series. But here we go. The Justice Society logo letters have a red to orange gradient and a blue background. And above the logo is a caption of "The Last Hurrah." The team is racing towards the reader with Flash in the center, and left to right going clockwise are the Atom, Hourman, Sandman, Hawkman, Green Lantern, Wildcat, and Dr. Midnight. There is a purple background, which is light in the center and darker at the borders, with speed lines matching the hero's direction. Oh, and the comic has been renamed Justice Society of, period. Because Alan's cape is covering America.
You're not wrong. Yes.
And this is just a glorious cover. I mean, it's fully channeling, you know, Jay's golden age face with his super squinty eyes and his posture. It's just wonderful. And I like Al Pratt's hands. He's got like one open and one closed, like a, you know, fist. And then the other hand's kind of like ready for grappling. It's really very cool pose. And variations of this image pop up everywhere. I mean, like in the house ad that was out there for this very series, it looked very similar to this. No surprise to have Flash in the center running towards you, because that's like a classic thing to do. I mean, he's going to be in the middle of the action and coming at you. But just having all the heroes around him like that, it's like they just did this just fairly recently. And oh, it's really, really a great cover. What do you think about it, Shag?
Well, I didn't pick up on the fact that you're right. The promotional poster that came out to promote this series had them running out on the baseball field from issue number one. But you're right. Mm-hmm. This is sort of a refiguring of that promotional poster they did, because J Jay's in the lead. The characters are sort of exploding, bursting out from behind him in that way. I did not even put the connection together. Yeah, I love this cover. It's without a doubt, it is my favorite cover of the series. There's a lot of other covers I love. And honestly, if there's been an episode where I claim some other cover was my favorite, I don't know. Because if you ever record a podcast, you'll find out that the moment you say something on a podcast, you completely forget what you said and it will come back to haunt you. But this cover is the Paperback JSA to me. And you talk about appearing in various places. I assume no one pays attention to what I do. But every episode, I make a custom logo for this show. And it says Justice at JSA in the 90s, and it's got the cover or whatever. But I have
You do that?
Exactly. I do have a generic JSA in the 90s logo I use for the show, and it's this cover. And I just photoshopped out a few things and slapped JSA in the 90s on it. It's because this cover is that good. I love the purple. I love the coloring. It's so striking. The incredible action shot. Everything you just said about Jay, I co-signed, the squinty eyes, all of it. I love that the Sandman or Hawkman are included because we didn't get to see them very much. I love Alan holding his cape. It looks so boss. And so this is a weird distraction, but I realized this as you were describing the Last Hurrah. It says the Last Hurrah across the top. For some reason, Last Hurrah sort of in a letter style. The is in a different letter style. Do you recognize the font, if you will, for the word the?
Is it the same font as they're using for Of America?
No, it's the same font as the Barry Allen The Flash series.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe they just cut it out and decided to use it. But yeah, the Barry Allen Flash series, you know, all through the Silver Age, it said The Flash, and that is the version of the word the. It's so strange.
I would not have picked that up. That is amazing.
And it has nothing to do with this cover, so forgive me even to spend time talking about it, but that's the thing. The corner box, it's got so this Justice Society of America logo is my favorite JSA logo of all time. I love the actual lettering of Justice Society of America, and then from time to time, they would just rip out of there the S and the A and make a little JSA logo, and they've got that in the corner box, which looks totally boss. So great cover. Yeah, just brings me so much joy. All right, well, let's get inside. So writer is Len Strzuski. Penciler is Mike Paraback. Inker is Mike Macklin. Letter is Robert Panaha. Colorist is Glenn Whitmore. Assistant editor is Ruben Diaz. Editor is Brian Augustine. And it's pretty interesting. It's been pretty much a consistent creative team across all 10 issues. Now, there's been a little variation on inkers here and there, but for the most part, the team has stayed the same the entire 10 issues. Well, nice.
Yeah.
The issue itself is entitled JSA No More. So you want to start us off with a recap?
I guess I have to. That's why I'm here, isn't it?
That is the whole reason you're invited. Yeah.
All right. Because you didn't want to write the first half of the recap. I don't blame you. It makes me sad. But we're going to do it anyway.
I got to close it out. That's harder.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Okay, let's hit it. So Ted Knight is in his observatory lab watching a torch-wielding mob screaming for blood with signs like, JSA must die. Suddenly, two Uzi-carrying thugs rappel into the lab, and they know Ted is Starman, shouting, the Eye of Power takes its revenge, and they fire. But Ted's cosmic rod stops the bullets, and the goons spill that cable TV told them to do this. Ted shoos them away, changes into green-capped Starman, and flies to Gotham. Speaking of, that's where the JSA is fighting Kulak the Sorcerer, plus the mesmerized Hawkman and Hawkgirl. Kulak revels in the power he's stealing from Johnny's impaled Thunderbolt. That power let him entrance millions to hate the JSA through Alan's cable TV network, and the furious Lantern attacks, just to have his power drained into the Thunderbolt. And then Flash's speed and Adam's atomic punch. Winning so handily, Kulak monologues a very biased story of getting dragged to the past, facing Vandal Savage, and rebuilding his power over centuries within the time capsule tomb that was opened by Carter and Shiera back in issues number 2 and 8. Well, because issue 2 didn't really show who was in it, and 8 was just a flashback to that part. But anyway, going on. Returning him to the U.S. and his plan to destroy the JSA. Meanwhile, Starman has reached Gotham and is disgusted at the riots cheering at videos of Kulak. So Ted blasts the screen, which confuses the crowd, and then he flies into space to lock onto Green Lantern's power ring and find his friends.
All right, well, I'll take it from there. So Kulak, the sorcerer of smugness, boasts about his plans for the JSA. He wants their debasement. He wants their humiliation. He wants their death. you know, the usual villain checklist. But Johnny Quick's Thunderbolt has a clever idea. Make Kulak burn through his own magical energy. So Johnny starts taunting Kulak, sort of how he taunts comic book nerds who are fans of the Bronze Age JLA. Kulak takes the bait and unleashes a horde of undead zombies. And yes, we get a glorious two-page splash of the JSA versus the Walking Dead. But then, shocker, the zombies start trashing Kulak's own TV studio. Kulak starts blasting his own minions, draining even more of his mystical mojo. Then Ted Knight Starman arrives, who shows up like a cosmic boss and zaps Kulak with a stellar blast that knocks loose his creepy third eye. With his power depleted, Kulak gets sucked into a dimensional vortex by the very zombies he summoned. And that's what we call magical irony, folks. Then we shift gears. The final three pages are a quiet epilogue, narrated by Jesse Quick's dissertation on the impact of superheroes on society. It's thoughtful, it's reflective, and it gives us a moment with nearly every JSA member, including Alan Scott Green Lantern and Carter Hall Hawkman, as they are bickering over who should chair the next JSA meeting, each urging on the other. In the end, Alan convinces Carter to take on the role as chairperson, like the way they were in the olden days, even if it might be for just one last time. And then the final page of this volume of Justice Society of America, it features the roster of classic JSA members from this series in a pose echoing the cover of All-Star Comics number 3. We have Hawkman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Wildcat, The Atom, Hourman, Johnny Thunder, Hawkwoman, The Sandman, and Starman. The team sitting around that round table, Hawkman taps the gavel and says, "I call to order this meeting of the Justice Society of America." So, not a bad way to end the series, you know, with a classic team, an iconic pose, and a whole lot of heart. So, Tim, a lot to unpack here. You want to start us off?
Yeah, sure. Let's get right into it, even though the more we talk about it, the sooner we're going to be done, which makes me sad.
Yeah.
But it's such a great story, such a great issue. Let's go all the way to the beginning where we have Ted Knight. We have two Teds and we have two Allens on this team. That's not confusing at all. And I mean that sincerely. You can have two people with the same name in the same team. It's fine.
But it's interesting. I mean, the JSA, we do tend to refer to a lot of them by their secret identity. I mean, part of that is to distinguish, you know, Alan Scott from Hal Jordan. But still, some of it, though, is too because, you know, hey, Ted Grant, he's Ted. That's who Wildcat is. He's Ted, you know?
Yes, and he is. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. So one thing I thought of note right away was the fact that these people really do know that Ted is Starman. And I was trying to piece together, had that been covered anywhere before this issue that his identity was public?
So I think that's a function of this story, because last issue, the possessed crowd also seemed to know that Dr. Charles McKnighter was Dr. Midnight. So it's the best no prize I can come up with is that Kulak is beaming this into people's heads of who to go after and hate. And once the spell breaks, it sort of wears off. Like, for example, when Starman blasts that TV later, the crowd look very confused, like the spell's broken. And they're like, "Oh, what am I doing? What's going on here?" So I think we can infer that Kulak has told them who they are and they'll forget later.
Yep, and that's one thing that definitely the story here makes me feel like. I do have some other tidbits that I researched to figure out about this.
Oh, and, wow, cool. What you got?
Right. Well, like, let's go to Will Payton's Starman series.
Right.
And the issues that were written by Roger Stern, but after Tom Lyle left the series.
Yeah.
I think it was Dave Hoover who drew it. We have a new Starman wearing the classic costume, and it's Ted's son, David.
Issue 26, I know it well.
Yep, and he goes on TV to call out the Will Payton Starman to fight for the identity, and says, "My father was the Starman." And so they don't actually say his civilian name on air in any of the panels, but I find that to be very telling in terms of it being a way to say that David made it be public knowledge that his father was Starman at some point.
Interesting.
So we might have a seed of him being a public figure after all. because at this time, they weren't expecting him to come back.
Right, exactly. Yeah, what's the point of protecting identity if the character's gone, right? I do want to mention, in this very issue, Ted's thinking about things going, how well they're going, and he says he's rebuilding his relationship with his son, which is absolutely a nod to that issue that you mentioned, so I love that.
Exactly. Yeah, I love that too. And I also can't help but realize and think about the fact that there's no mention of Jack in that sort of thing.
Well, so Jack was created in Starman number Zero, as far as I know.
Well, yeah, his first appearance was Zero Hour number One.
Oh, so okay. So it would have been Zero Hour number One. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Starman number Zero is right in there too,
yeah,
but okay.
Yeah. But it's all, yeah, because that's all that was, it was really there. It was, he was there just to lead to that. But then, you know, David being killed was the big thing for making Jack become Starman.
Spoiler!
So, oh, yeah, absolutely. Is that not public knowledge? As we're talking about this 30-year-old comic?
30-year-old comic that kicks off the whole series? Yeah, I think probably David didn't make it out of the first few pages.
Yeah. So it's just kind of funny to look at the fact that, oh yeah, no, they weren't even planning those things at all. At those things, there was no hint about there being another son, nothing like that. So, which I don't expect there to be, but it's just noting it for the historical standpoint.
Yep.
So I really dig that part. And then on page four we have the green helmet. I understand that that's a little controversial.
Oh my gosh, are we really doing that?
It's not to me.
Okay.
It's not to me. I think it's a great look.
Yeah.
I think it works really well, and I think it works well with his cape. So.
If you're new to the show, yes, the Starman with the green cowl has been a very controversial topic throughout the run of this podcast. Because, yes, he first appeared in that promotional poster we just referenced with the green cowl, and then in issue number one, and then here. So, yeah, I'm on board. I think the green cowl looks great. I don't wear the same shirt every day. I mean, I might wear it a couple days. But either way, and so I think it's very reasonable that he has different looks. So the green cowl works for me. And like you said, it looks great with a cape. And they've explained, and we did hear from some of the creators, that the whole reason it got colored that way is because the way Mike and Mike, meaning Mike Paraback and Mike Macklin, the way they inked it, it looked as if it was one piece, not a separate piece. So the colors went with, okay, it's a single piece, so it's the same color as the cape.
Yep. So it's just great. And really, I love the fact that we are getting him in the book. I mean, we hadn't seen him since issue one, but to have Ted Knight back in the book and has such a big role in this issue. Just loved it.
Yeah.
Love that part.
So I wanted to touch on that a little bit. So first of all, hooray for Ted Knight. Yes, more of that, please. So we see in New Mexico his observatory with the giant telescope, which is great. And, you know, I know that was in the previous 8-issue miniseries as well. But I was trying to think, when was that first established? Was it the 8-issue miniseries where they first established his observatory? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone does, I'd be interested to know where they first established that. Because obviously it doesn't. He moves to Opal City, or goes back, I should say, to Opal City, I guess, in the Starman series is the way they explain it. But I just found that sort of nice continuity from one series to the next.
I don't know where that happened either, but it also is interesting to me with Will Payton being a Southwest superhero, that this is where Ted Knight has his observatory also. I don't think that's an accident.
Wow, look at the big brain on Tim. Very clever. Because, yeah, that would make sense. If David's challenging him, he's not challenging him from across the country, he's challenging him regionally, that would work really well. Wow. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I like that Ted, when he gets attacked, you know, he obviously takes care of himself, which is great. Even out of costume with that boss, you know, like he's the guy who wore the 3-piece suit to work, but he's taking the jacket off, loosened the tie, undone the vest. He's wearing the red power tie from the 90s, and yet he still takes care of business, which is great.
Rolled up his sleeves a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. This is the after hours look in the 90s. I remember it well. So the guys are shooting at him, and you know, he doesn't put it together that it's Kulak. I like that, because that would have been a little too much of a coincidence. But he decides it's time to get involved. And they tell him it's Gotham, and I love the quote, or it's a thought balloon. It's chilly up in Gotham. Better bring my long johns. And he's in it, the costume's right behind him. It's an incredibly boss page. And just what a hero shot. The panel design, it's three panels. Or really, I guess you could say it's a fourth with Starman across the top of it. And there's these nice horizontal angles from, you know, right to left going down, where you've got the creeps following, you've got him looking at the costume, then you've got him flying out in the costume. It's just amazing hero shot. Love, love, love everything on this page.
Absolutely. Well, and I don't know why I thought about this, but I guess it's because of his appearance in Jack Knight's series that, you know, Ted there looks so much smaller and frailer because he's supposed to be older, obviously.
Yes.
But I will admit that my father-in-law passed away a few years ago, sadly.
I'm so sorry.
Was a great, great guy. And played football when he was in college, was probably the same height as me when I first met him, but in the 20 years since then, he only got like an inch shorter.
Mm-hmm.
You don't lose height of like half a foot, mm-hmm. which is kind of what happened to Ted between here and the Jack Knight series. And trust me, as an older guy who was starting to have some problems, he was still a solid frame, and and it was took some effort to be able to help him. So I kind of just I knew his artistic license with Ted back then, but it's a thing that I just thought about because of the depictions there. And this, you know, this book is going to make you think a little bit about aging. It's part of the themes.
Yep. Well, and there is a dramatic aging between this point and just 2 years from now, which is crazy to think the Jack Knight Starman book starts 2 years after this, is Zero Hour does happen. And mm-hmm. all of those heroes get aged drastically. So Ted does go from being in the physique of maybe late 50s is maybe what he's supposed to be here. I'm not sure. To mm-hmm. being like a 75-year-old guy that fast. Like you said, you don't shrink half a foot, but...
Yeah. You don't lose skeleton.
Right.
You lose muscle mass.
Yeah. But and it is artistic license. But yeah, I get what you're saying. But also, he does take a big hit aging-wise, too.
Yeah, very true. Well, picking up back to the action in Gotham City, we have the Thunderbolt on a pike, which is a chilling image.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's magical and we know, well, you know, he's probably okay. It's still... It's nothing to balk at. And then we have Kulak, and I just have to talk about his outfit a little bit. Because here he has three eyes already on his head.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes out of his way to have a headband with another big eye on it. And an eye on his chest emblem. I guess the eyes have it? I don't know.
Gosh. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, you worked on that for a while. That's really bad.
He just wants to flaunt the fact that he has a third eye so badly. I don't understand that.
He learned branding from Bruce Wayne. It's got to be what it is. You just, it's all about the brand.
Yeah. But not necessarily good branding, though.
Right. Well, we have to mention as well, you know, there by Kulak's side is one of his other mental slaves is Hawk Woman or Hawk Girl. I think you and I decided it's Hawk Girl probably still at this point, technically. But she's there being mind controlled, and she makes one great looking Wolverine. I don't know if you noticed that or not.
You are not wrong. That is really, I had not noticed that, but the mask is a perfect Wolverine mask in that.
Yes.
All these panels, actually.
I can't unsee it that Hawk Woman is, so there we go.
So she was Wolverining before Roy Thomas.
Right. She's the best there is at what she does, and what she does isn't pretty, so.
Or maybe it is pretty,
well,
depending
on
your point of view.
It is true. Mike Parabek does not draw her like a 75-year-old woman, folks. Not at all. Wow. But we do need to talk about something here. So Kulak has got her in his thrall. He's bragging about it. He says about Hawkman, he goes, I have his delicious companion, body and soul. He licks her shoulder with his creepy, super long tongue. She, meanwhile, is also in his thrall and sort of, she's standing up, but she's leaning backwards, sort of being like the little spoon kind of situation. It's very sexual imagery, okay? Mm-hmm. It's very sexual. And she's like, enjoying it. It's really gross, like inappropriately gross. I don't know if it's necessarily inappropriate for a DC all-ages comic. I mean, it's not crossing a line, but it's just inappropriate in general, right? And
mm-hmm.
and I am not a terribly enlightened guy. I've tried to be better in recent years, so I lack sort of the vocabulary to articulate what I'm trying to say here. But because it's not like the term fridging, because there a woman is killed to advance a man's story, but it's certainly mm-hmm. like that. I mean, her agency has been taken away. She is being controlled by the bad guy in order to push the male stories forward. So it's creepy, sexual, inappropriate with her. I don't know the terminology for it, but it just doesn't feel good. There could have been ways to show her, you know, working for the bad guy and being controlled without the creepy sexual mm-hmm. stuff.
I think what I keep classifying this as an assault. It actually is an assault on her. She is not a willing participant in this. She's only acting like a willing participant because it's mind control.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we don't have that in the real world, minus chemicals and things like that.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but that's what it is. And that's why it rubs wrong so strongly. That's what's giving us such a big reaction is that, she's not doing this of her own volition. And that's what makes it really gross. And that's where my only comment for it was, ew, I really, and you knew exactly what I meant.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, if we can accept it a little bit as a statement of the time and that this was not viewed the same way it is now, we can still take it as, okay, it's just showing how bad of a bad guy Kulak is.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely what they're trying to demonstrate. Yes.
So I can take it at that and move along without just slamming the issue closed and saying, I'm done with it.
Like, exactly.
No, it's, yeah, we just, okay, he's a bad guy. We got it. And thankfully, they don't continue this. They just do it the one time, and then we move on.
It's a panel and a half. That's it. And we move on. Yep.
Well, so let's see. Next up, I was going over to page number 9, where we have the flashback. Did you have anything before we got to that section?
Well, on page 7, I did want to mention there's just a particular panel, just because I love Parabek so much. There's a great panel where he's Kulak has blasted Green Lantern. He's sucked away Alan's energy from the ring. But there's this great panel where Alan's, it's the second panel on page 7, he can't get his ring to work. And it just, Parabek has drawn it so great. He's making it cartoony without being ridiculous. So Alan obviously has the whatever that mask is called that the Green Lanterns wear. I don't know which. It's not a domino mask. Oh my gosh, I don't have enough caffeine right now to come up with a phrase. We'll just call it the Stickiani mask, Green Lanterns wear. Anyway, and he's raising his eyebrow, squinting one eye. Clearly the mask isn't going to change shape like that, you know, and all that, but it looks great here. It's an awesome panel, and he's looking at his ring. He's like, hey, what'd you do to my ring? And it's just, the picture tells you everything. You don't even need the word balloon to know that Alan's like, WTF, man? Because that's what people talk like in World War II, by the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Like the kids say.
Yep.
And you're absolutely right. His facial expression on that panel, just hilarious and picture perfect on storytelling.
Yep. So you were going to say page 9. Let's talk about the flashback.
Yeah. So in the flashback, first off, they say that the last appearance of Kulak was in All-Star Comics number 2. Gosh, one issue before the JSA actually debuted.
Mm-hmm.
That's very fascinating. And I do know from a little bit of research that, you know, he fought the Spectre in that story.
And only the Spectre.
Spectre. Even nobody else.
Regardless what's in the art of this image, folks, he only fights the Spectre in that story. Yep.
I do love the image, though. It is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because we also see Dr. Midnight, Alan, Green Lantern, and Jay Flash, and Black Canary.
Yeah.
Which means original Black Canary, not the Silver Age and current Birds of Prey Black Canary. It means her mom.
Yep.
Which also is a point of, we're still at that time when there was no Wonder Woman in the Justice Society.
Right.
I like that inclusion.
It creates a little bit of a problem in that they're saying that this is supposed to be in All-Star Comics number 2 from 1940. Unfortunately, Dr. Midnight's first appearance wouldn't be for another year. Black Canary's first appearance wouldn't be for another 6 years. So you do have some problems there, unless they're saying that Black Canary had been around much earlier, which I actually, there's been a lot of debate about that, whether Black Canary should have been, do you stick with the 1947 first appearance, or do you say she was there during World War II, because they've been doing that a lot lately. I'm fine with her being around during World War II. I think it's great. I think she's a great character. But either way, please continue.
Well, I agree completely. I think that at this point in post-crisis, and even if with the later inclusion of Hippolyta coming back to be in the JSA, I do think let's just fudge it a little bit. Let's move Black Canary's first appearance a few years earlier so that she can fill in for Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
I think that's fine. That doesn't bother me in the slightest. But also, Kulak's actual previous last appearance was in All-Star Squadron, issues numbers 27 and 28.
Yep, exactly right.
So I'm not going to, you know, get too mad at the editor, but it's like, they probably should have said that instead. And that would have worked. All these things kind of would have worked a little bit better.
Yeah.
I did read that story for the first time, just preparing for this show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because I have a problem. My problem is that now, thanks to these subscriptions and all the digital comics in the world at my fingertips, I have all the digital comics in the world at my fingertips.
The completest dilemma is real.
It totally is. That describes my comic book collecting to a T. But yeah, it's a bonker story. And I appreciate them name-dropping Vandal Savage in here. It's kind of a hint that if they'd kept going, we would have seen some Vandal Savage perhaps in this series. They would have gotten there eventually, I'm sure.
Well, I think it's also this conflict of they want Kulak to be Cheops, the Pharaoh, but they had previously established that Vandal Savage was Cheops, and so they're trying to deal with the fact that, because he even says, he had to deal with a pretender to my name, and then Al calls it out and says, I thought Vandal Savage was Cheops. So, they played with the continuity. I think that's kind of fun to deal with that continuity hiccup that way.
I kind of read it a little differently in that he perhaps took on the role of Cheops temporarily from Savage, but Savage then came back to, you know, unseat him. But Kulak leaves that part out of the story. The images tell us that, but what he says to the JSA leaves out the part that, yeah, then Savage came back and kicked my butt and stuck me in a coffin. You know, it's like, he's like, oh, it was all part of my plan, you know, to then come into to my tomb to regain my power. It's like, that's not what happened. What happened is Vandal Savage kicked you on your hiney and you got trapped in there for centuries, but it still let you regenerate your powers. So, and then you luckily got found by Carter and Shiera. So he's being, to me, a very unreliable narrator, and they do a good job with it here in that the narration box gives us the part that he says to the JSA, but the pictures tell us what really happened.
Oh, you're right. I didn't even pick up on that. You're right, because even if you go back earlier, when he's getting yanked into the portal, he's saying, I conducted my retreat into the mist. I was already planning my revenge, and yet he's being dragged away, and he looks surprised. Mm-hmm. Then later, I chose to reemerge deep in the past, but he's falling and landing on his head. Yeah, you're right. The whole way through, he's an unreliable narrator. I did not even pick up on that. Oh, geez. Yeah, that's great.
Well, you know, and that's Al and Ted calling him out on it, calling his BS.
Yep.
That's other little hint that the JSA is listening to him, but they're like, no, this isn't up.
And really, as a JSA fan, I mean, you want Vandal Savage to have the more premium spot anyway, because as me and several of my guests have expressed during this run, many of us have gone, Kulak who? You know, so.
Oh, yeah. That was really great. Let's see. Oh, well, and I like this little interlude with Starman coming to Gotham. That's always fun. And showing again that, you know, television is bad.
Yep.
And, you know, television will tell people to do all sorts of wrong. Thank goodness we don't have problems like that nowadays.
Okay.
Anyway.
Not touching that.
Probably for the best.
Did you notice he doesn't call it a cosmic rod or a gravity rod?
I did notice that he had no title for it. I actually had to look it up just to make sure for myself what I wanted to use in my synopsis. But yeah, he doesn't give it a full name at all. No.
Yeah, I mean, he's totally bad. First of all, as we said, he looks amazing. It's showing how powerful he is. Because, like, we very rarely ever see Ted Knight in action as Starman, you know, in the later years. I mean, I'm sure there's scenes in All-Star Squadron probably here and there. But beyond that, I mean, it's very rarely in here. We don't really see him in the Starman series. I never really think about how powerful he was. And here he is smashing the crap out of stuff and doing all kinds of calculations with a cosmic rod. And it's very impressive.
Yeah, I'm on the bottom of page 12. That one panel is, and the panel right above it, are such Superman looks.
Yeah.
He's like filling in that part of the history. Even it gives you the impression of him doing that. And the fact that he wears Superman style boots doesn't hurt either.
Right. Well, the squinty eyes take it a long way as well.
Yes, indeed. So just great stuff. Well, let's see. On page 13, I love the Adam saying, Johnny Thunder with a plan. Give me a break.
And it really does boil down to, like, and this is where I think we have a flaw in the issue, which is Kulak's been built up for three issues as the big bad here, or this is the third issue of building Kulak up as the big bad. So you're expecting a huge fight. Now, probably because the series ended, they had to wrap this up faster than they would have, or in a different way, because really it gets wrapped up with Johnny Thunder using his wits, shockingly, based upon Thunderbolt's advice, tricking Kulak into using his power, and then Starman comes in and just blasts him once. I mean, really, it's boom, boom, and it's over. Which is a bit of a disappointment because, again, it's been building up for so many issues, so it's just over that fast. But again, I have to chalk that up to simply what's going on with the pacing of the book. But yeah, Johnny Thunder, imagine that.
Not I. Based on the previous appearances I'd seen with him, no. And then it is funny because I did a reading project back in 2022, I think. That's right. Yeah, 2022, where I was reading a JLA issue a day.
Right, I remember.
Yeah, and when I finished Volume 1, I had a choice of either trying to go to something else in the future with JLA or going back to the past and maybe reading All-Star Comics with the JSA, and that's what I chose to do.
Okay.
So I read all the issues that the DCU app has. I didn't try to find other ones. I just what they had. And boy, Johnny in those first few years of stories, oh, he's supposed to be funny, but he is so not.
Yeah.
He is so annoying. But then when Black Canary joins the team, then he straightens out and he's actually interesting, but he's only there for a couple issues before, you know, he gets the boot because Black Canary's there.
Gotcha. Well, and I know during the Bronze Age stories, he's a bit of a pill and people don't like him there either. Right. So I really do feel like there was a bit of a redemption going on for him in this series. Because I people who walk in not liking him probably don't like him here. For me, I find him very charming in this in these issues.
Yeah, I can separate him from those eras. Is that, yeah, I didn't, what he was like in the humorous era, the Golden Age, not so much. But no, I loved him in this story.
Yeah.
Because he's always the everyman who has a magic genie.
Right.
That's who he is. And boy, he is so relatable, but a good person. I mean, I have nothing but good things to say about Johnny Thunder in this series.
And I feel like I can't be too critical as the guy who lived in a glass house made a firestorm for like 8 years, the dumb jock with a lot of power, and this is just the dumb idiot with a lot of power. I mean, it's there's a template there. So
just a little bit. Well, on 17, I noticed this. I think it's also in the digital, but I for sure noticed on my physical copy that all of a sudden the helmet of Ted has changed from green to red.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow. That's a major coloring mistake there. Interesting. Yeah. By the way, in that same panel, he calls the cosmic rod or the star...
Star rod. There it is. Yeah. There's the name.
He calls it star rod, which I've never heard. Or I've heard cosmic rod. I've heard gravity rod. I've never heard star rod before.
Yeah, that's the first I've ever seen that.
I think what's happened here, he's flying so fast coming from space down to track down Alan that he's actually the Doppler effect, I think is what it's called, has changed the color. So it's actually changed from green to red for these panels, because once he stops and he's fighting Kulak, it's green again. So there you go. There's your no prize.
Oh, that I guess that is right, because he's flying towards us, which would make it red from compressing the wavelengths. Whereas if we were behind him, it should be turning to blue. Sure, right. Yeah.
You're welcome, America.
Science stuff. Thanks.
Yep.
Thanks, Professor Shag. But I mean, we were talking about this before, about how powerful Starman is. And I do feel like that, yeah, you're right about how short the fight is, but boy, it is easy to forget how powerful Starman really is.
Yeah.
He's just a guy with a stick.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Or you chalk him up to being a lesser Green Lantern.
I was going
to
say, it's just like Green Lantern's a guy with a ring. You know, it's sort of like, yeah. I mean, the cosmic rod, at least for me, without studying it dramatically, the James Robinson series is excluded. In the old comics, the cosmic rod kind of did whatever it needed to do. It's kind of was always the way I read the stories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I do like him charging in to save the day and just being a boss hero. Now, also, the humor, I am mixed mind on Kulak and him sounding almost too modern about the television situation.
Yeah.
This isn't in my script.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the other thing he said? Come on, you stiffs. They're just a bunch of old men. It's like that. They haven't really been writing him that way throughout the rest of the issue. So it's kind of a strange take.
He became very quickly like a 1980s reoccurring cartoon villain. He became Skeletor, I'll get you, you know, or, you know, foiled again, or, you know, Silas Greenback in Danger Mouse. Like he became suddenly the schmo who's going to get defeated and be, you know, unhappy about it. It's what it felt like.
Mm. And not to get ahead of ourselves, but I was paging through the 8-issue miniseries as well, kind of think about some stuff before reading this. The idea of a villain using television, it's in that series too. So I feel like it's a weird parallel, not a deliberate callback.
Well, it's the same writer. So, So, and you know, Starman, if I recall, because I haven't reread that eight issue series in a while, goes through a hard time in that series.
He does.
So he could have been.
Yeah, he does.
As this comes out just a year later, same writer, maybe he was beginning to work towards a redemption arc for Starman, and this was going to be the beginning of it, where he kind of gets back in action and gets his life together again. But obviously, they didn't get the chance, and that's also why they wrapped it up so quickly. Same thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it makes a lot of sense, and they're doing a great job at it because, boy, he is a boss in this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So good.
When that eyeball pops out, so he blasts Kulak in the eye, the eyeball pops out with a boink, They're like, doink, doink, doink. Watch that eyeball later, because I'm going to bring it up again later. But then he gets yanked into the vortex by his goons, his zombies, which they set up earlier, which is nice, in the flashback. Because I felt the flashback was a little excessive at first, but now I understand they were showing us the zombies pulling him into the vortex there or whatever, and so they're showing him getting pulled into the vortex again. So it was set up that delivers.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So that's all good storytelling. Go figure.
Yep, yep.
But yeah, that eyeball popping out. Oh, yeah. His eye's not supposed to do that.
Remember that eyeball. I've got a point I'm going to make in a moment.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, yep. My next thing is on the very next page.
All right.
Let's write something before then.
That's good. So we're talking about, now we're getting into Jesse Quick's dissertation, right? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Finally, we get Jesse and Kiki appear in the comic.
I know, right?
We haven't had them for the last issue and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, where are the new characters?
Yeah.
And then there's the very first panel with that, the and only panel that Jesse and Kiki are in. And Jesse's typing on her computer. And there's a stack of papers nearby.
Oh, so you noticed it too. Okay, yes.
I did notice that too.
Yes. On the stack of papers as a paperweight, and it's got to be intentional, is Kulak's eye. Maybe it was a glass eye and it's not so gross, but I don't know. I don't know that they had that kind of. I don't know. Either way, it's gross. It's icky. But yeah, his eyeball is a paperweight. Yep, yep, yep.
It is hilarious.
Yeah.
But when you think about it too much, a little gross.
I do love these three pages. It's a little bit of Return of the King, checking in on everyone. You get little moments, little vignettes with each character. At least, again, you don't get enough with Jesse or Kiku or also Johnny Quick, who technically, I think Johnny Quick's not really part of the team now that Jesse is. But still, right. He's been important to the series. So
yeah,
you get a funny little conversation between Wildcat, Ted, and Al Pratt, and he's talking about his costumes. He says, "I'm giving up the shorts. I look ridiculous," which is a funny comment because Adam always wore shorts, and now he's saying, "I'm an old man. I shouldn't do it." The only thing that's a little odd about that is he hasn't worn the shorts since issue one. He's had the new costume the entire series, so he gave up the shorts 10 issues ago, but that's okay.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at that particular comment being there, although I'll take it to be a conversation of Ted and him riffing, and something came in like, oh, man, I can't wait for you to get back in the shorts. It's like, I'm not wearing the shorts anymore.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's a good way to look at it.
That does feel like them. I love Jay's wink to the audience, his wink to the reader. It's, and the little tip of the hat, it just makes me so happy.
Yep. I love seeing Dr. McKnighter. He's in his Dr. Midnight costume without the cowl, and he's performing a physical on Wesley Dodds, a Sandman. And he's telling him he's ship-shaped and can be a hero again. So he's recovered from his stroke, which is wonderful to hear. Because at this point, Sandman Mystery Theater's on the shelves as well. So it's nice to see him there.
Absolutely. And then on the next page, continuing those things, we have Shiera talking to Johnny Thunder. She's looking very fetching as she's talking to him.
Parabek always draws her like a 24-year-old woman, so.
yeah, go figure. It's nice to see Ted and Rex talking to each other and talking about the chemo helping Rick out. And then we have Alan and Carter having the silliest argument in the world. It's like, you do it. No, you do it. No, you do it.
I think it's appropriate, though, because Alan is the chairman of the JSA at this point. That's his job. And so, because you don't know what they're arguing about at first, right? But then he finally explains what, because you see on the previous page, they're arguing behind, but you don't see the dialogue. I wondered what they were arguing about. And then you get to this point and you find out they're each trying to be nice to the other. One thing I didn't think about, you see Carter Hall start to take his glasses off, right? I didn't realize, I didn't think about the Hawkman mask must have prescription lenses in it now because of his age, which is hysterical to think about.
That's great. That is a great touch. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
Yep.
And also, well, we know there's no way his regular glasses will fit under that.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, if Batman can fit a mask under a mask, maybe. But by the way, I'll call it, I am on team Carter Hall full shirt, in his geriatric years. I know a lot of people are like, no, Hawkman's supposed to be the straps. Dude, he's like 75 years old. I've seen my father without his shirt on. No, no. Full shirt is absolutely the right move for Carter Hall. Mm-hmm.
I just actually like the design. Honestly, I really like the design. It just gives a bit more color to it. I think he looks tougher that way. So,
the way they kind of notch it out around the pectoral muscles gives it still the echo of the straps. So it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we have our final image, which is nicknamed Camelot, because that's what it definitely feels like. As you said, it's callback to the very first cover of the JSA. It's beautiful.
Yeah. you get Hawkman in the lead position. To his left is Green Lantern, just similar to the way... Because the characters on the cover of All-Star number 3 aren't exactly the same. Like, you don't have Dr. Fate, you don't have Spectre, things like that. You've got mm-hmm. more characters, so they've had to move them around a tad. The only one that sort of surprised me is they've got Sandman on completely opposite side of the table than he is on the cover of number 3, which isn't really that big a deal, but whatever. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, Al Pratt the Atom, you've got female Wolverine... sorry, Shira. Beautiful redhead wearing a Wolverine's mask. Johnny Thunder. You get the back of Starman, which looks great with the star on the back of his cape, and Hourman, and it's just such a great, great image. It really sums up a lot of feelings I have for this series.
And that is, as it says on the page, the end of the story.
If I could tweak that last page somehow, the only thing I would do would be add Jesse Quick and Kiku, because they are part of the team at this point. But I get that they're mm-hmm. just trying to show the classic members. These are just the geriatric classic members, and that's okay. But I would have loved to see Jesse Quick. Jesse Quick's a full-blown member. I mean, she is part of the team at this point, so I wish she'd been there. So overall, you know, was the ending rushed? Absolutely, right? But they had no choice. They were told, you got 10 issues, get it done. And that's what they did. And I think he still pulled off those last three pages as being very touching. He got a lot crammed into three pages. And the partnership of Len's script and Parabek's art, it was a wonderful capstone to the issue, I think.
Couldn't agree more.
All right, so let's break down some of the other stuff in the issue here very quickly. I don't try to talk about the house ads all the time, but man, there's just so many here. It's such a time capsule. You get a house ad for Adventures of Superman number 500. You know, Superman has died 5 months previously, and here we see him fighting in the afterlife. And the quote says, "The Battle of Doomsday was the fight of his life. Now the Man of Steel is fighting to live again. You can kill the man, but his spirit lives on." And I was working in the comic shops at this time, and the hype was real. I mean, mm-hmm. For the first time, those kids who had watched, you know, who had bought every Image Comics number one and all the X-Men and the X-Force, they were talking about Superman, and it was crazy. There's a teaser image of Superboy in the back there, but they've got all blanked out, so all you can see is silhouette. You don't know what it is, which is great. They got a Batman Nightfall ad in here. There's two Bloodlines ads, so they're woohoo.
That's insane.
I know, right? I know. You get a Blood Syndicate ad, and then not a house ad, but it does take the entire inside cover. It's an ad for the Coneheads movie, which to me is just like the ultimate sign that the 90s had gone too far. The Coneheads movie, like, oh, we made a big mistake in the 90s, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Okay. So the letters pages we're talking about, there is a big letter from Len Straczynski. I will include it on the Image Gallery so you can read the whole thing. There's also a farewell from assistant editor Ruben Diaz. But there's a couple things I want to shout out about Len's letter that I thought was really nice. Len Straczynski, he addresses quite a bit about superheroes as senior citizens and how he approached it. He speaks of some real-life influential historical speakers that he has seen speak in their geriatric years. And these folks, you know, they fought for important rights and into their senior years were still speaking out of these topics, and they inspired him. So thinking of these real-life senior citizens who stood up when others didn't want to listen, this is what Len writes. He says, "They've been around, taken some lumps, given some back, and have survived with their integrity intact. Eventually, their end would come, but until then, they would continue on as they had before, representing the ideals they had always represented. So as I thought about the JSA, I figured that when you fought Hitler, the ultra-humanite, Vandal Savage, and had been sent to another dimension to stave off the end of the universe, it's hard to be upset by a few wrinkles and gray hairs. As I've written these past 10 issues, that's the model I've used for the JSA. Older, grayer, a little less active, but strong where it counts in their hearts." And that was beautiful to me. I really love that. And through the run of this podcast, at least of these issues, you know, some different guests, right, commenters as well, they've all expressed various opinions on the issue, some being critical. Some being critical mm-hmm. of the characters' depictions, some the faithfulness to continuity, some about story pacing. I called out a pacing issue myself today. And that's all fair, right? But as I read this farewell letter from Len, for me, I don't want to say all is forgiven, but his heart's clearly in the right place as he approached this series. So that goes a long way for me. What about you?
Yeah, I read that letter as well in my copy here, and I felt this pretty much the same way. I mean, I co-sign all of that. I feel it more nowadays, probably, than I did when I was in my 20s.
Oh, right.
I'm a few years older now than then, just a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, cards on the table. I'm 57, people. So And you could look at these guys, look at the characters that he's doing here and how they're presented and how they live and how they fight. And you go, yeah, you can still have it when you're at that age and you have something to contribute and something to say. It just spoke so much to Len's reverence for that. And also kind of the statement himself of saying, I hope I'm like that when I'm that age.
Right.
I think that's what we really want to hold on to ourselves for there.
To still stand up and say when something's wrong is something I hope that I'm willing to do when I'm in my golden years. Absolutely.
Now, one thing I'm going to throw at you, which is a little bit of a tangent. I'm going to say this is perhaps a Sean Ross-ish secret question sort of thing. Is there a senior citizen in your own life that was inspiring to you? Wondered about that. If you need a second, I can tell you what mine is really easy.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay. So as many people have heard me talk about, is that I'm now directing a community theater. Mm-hmm. And it only started 2 years ago because the previous director had some health issues and needed to step down. But, you know, let's also focus on that for a second in that, you know, Joellen had been directing that theater for 50 years.
Wow.
And she was 83, still directing. And she really didn't plan to completely step down. It's just she had some major health things knock her off her feet. And so she's not doing so great now. But just think about the fact that I was going to rehearsals over, you know, the course of like 5 years and having this short 80-year-old woman coming up and saying, well, we need to try to do that part again. And she would be there four nights a week in the evening, because that's the only time the cadets could come rehearse. And she would show up an hour early to get things ready. And she would always be the last one to leave. I would stay with her until she left many times to make sure that somebody was with her when she left, because I was worried about her leaving on her own. But she would have left on her own. She would have said, oh, you can go. It's like, no, Joellen, I'm not leaving. But, you know, the love she gave to what she wanted to do with her life was so sincere. And she loved theater. She loved everything about it. That's why she couldn't delegate, because she loved all of it. And I don't want to be directing that long. I freely admit, I do not want to be directing that late in my life. But, you know, she is still the heart and soul of that theater, even without her presence there. And every show I do, in whether I say it or not, is dedicated to her, because she shows what it's all about.
Wow. That's very moving, Tim. That's incredible. And to have that experience, to have a partner, if you will, there with you, pushing you to do better and pushing you to keep at it, and inspiring you, that's amazing. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So what do you have now that you had a chance to think about it?
Well, yeah, I'm a little bit on the spot, so my answer is not going to be terribly creative. And I'm sure tonight at 2 a.m, I'm going to go, why didn't I think of that? I'll pick my father. My father's 85, and he constantly amazes me with, and it's, this is going to sound weird, it's not about when he was a senior citizen, it's about what he did when he was younger, is really what it is. He accomplished an insane amount of things before I was even born. And so in his 20s, you know, like out of sheer force of will, as a kid, he went down to the local theater, wanted to learn about it. And they said, tell you what, kid, you help us build sets. We'll teach you about the theater. So he, at, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, he's building sets for plays. He decides he wants to be on the radio. So he goes there and starts performing, playing instruments on the radio. He ends up on TV playing instruments and doing performances. He forms a band and they go on the road, and he ends up touring with some famous musicians at different points in that. Meanwhile, he's maintaining a career in sales doing that. Then what else did he do? He became a performing magician. And I don't mean just like kids' birthday parties. He would perform like for governors and things like that. He was not a full-time, this is a side gig. Meanwhile, again, doing this sales job on the side. He was a performing magician, doing weekend shows, you know, getting it out there, marketing it out there. He owned a magic shop. Like you would go and buy magic tricks or gag, because that was big in the 70s. You know, gag gifts, all kind, rent costumes, all this stuff. He owned a magic shop. He owned it. He managed it. He ran it. He did all of these things. and by that point, I was probably 5 or 6, but he was doing all this while maintaining a family of 4, you know, full-time job, all these things. Mm-hmm. Then in the 70s, and you may laugh at the sound of it, but this is legit, McDonald's recruited magicians to become Ronald McDonald and do performances. So he...
Oh, that's fun.
Went to Ronald McDonald College, as they called it. He learned how to clown. He learned the whole Ronald McDonald thing. He would go and perform in parades. He would go and do appearances at local McDonald's as Ronald McDonald. Or do close-up magic for kids because that's what they wanted. He did all of it. He never stopped. All the while still playing music, did all of these things. And I look at like, wow, I'm 53 now and yeah, I do a podcast, you know, on top of, you know, raising a family and having a job. I'm like, oh my gosh. And so it's inspiring to see someone that never stopped creating. He's still doing stuff at 85 that just blows me away in the things he's involved with. And off the top of my head, if I'm going to pick someone inspirational, it's the nonstop energy of my dad. So.
Oh, wow. There's nothing wrong with that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And to have, and to be lucky enough to have someone like that so much in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Well, you had a secret question for me. I have a kind of secret question because I did give you a hint about it last night. But a question that occurred to me as we were getting ready for this episode is this book, right? This beloved 10-issue JSA series. One of the big things that we all love about it, obviously, is the Mike Parabek art, right? It's gorgeous. It's absolutely iconic for superheroes. It's astonishing. If this book had been drawn by just a generic 1990s artist, I'm not saying a terrible artist, but just DC had a whole stable of generic 90s artists at this point, right? If someone other than Parabek, non-inspiring artists had drawn this, would people, including ourselves, still be talking about this book today? I'm curious to hear your answer. I want to hear the answers from people at home.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I'm glad that you gave me warning because I'm not as nice. But yeah, so I will say, you know, my knee-jerk statement is first off, yes, Mike Parabek's artwork was central to my love of this series. We all know, listeners as well, that we all know this medium so well that it is one of the unique combinations of two or more talents. And, you know, the writing and the artwork together. And when they work together, that's when real amazing things happen. And it's sometimes hard to truly separate them emotionally because they are, the heart and the mind don't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
We take them in together and they spur reactions, spur emotions, all as a composite. And without a doubt, Mike Parabek's artwork is just phenomenal. And I was just trying to really think about it, is that I took a, that's why I looked at the 8-issue miniseries briefly, because I kind of thought of those as samples of what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, none of them made me sing as much as the Parabek issues of that series. I mean, he did 2 issues of that series himself,
right?
But the other artists just didn't quite make it work the same way for me. And, but it also was a very different story because it was a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
But what Parabek brings to this is the characters feel timeless more than a period piece. And they look, they have that classic, iconic imagery, not, which kind of feels like an overused thing to do, but it's really about distilling down a character into the important parts that we see and making them work. And just like also distilling down emotions, like Green Lantern's mask and how he squints with one eye there. It's like, that's such an important thing about that. And he's such a master of it in this series that I think it's a huge part of it. Now, I did think about what if Tom Lyle, the cover artist from the miniseries, had drawn this.
Right.
I think it still would have sung and hit a lot of the right points because that was such a stand for Tom Lyle's artwork.
Absolutely.
But it would have felt like a different series.
Mm-hmm.
It would have felt very different. And I think also I've kind of said this a couple times, perhaps in the feedback. Another thing that in a weird way contributes to this book's rereadability is the fact that it only has 10 issues.
Mm-hmm.
If it had gone for 60 issues, I might not have reread it as much as I have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a gem. And you also get the fact of, hey, I can read these 10 issues and I'm going to have a great time. So should have been an unfortunate thing about it being cut short, but there's something to it. The fact that brevity, that scarcity, that makes it more treasured. So that's what I've been thinking about. I mean, obviously I've been thinking about it way too much. So, but I want to hear what you think, Shag.
Well, that was very interesting to hear you say on that long winding road of, I don't think you answered the question. I think you gave me a lot of maybes and whatever. Mm-hmm. Answer the question. Don't wait for the translation. Without Mike Parabek. Here you go. I'll rephrase it for you.
Shut up.
All right. Okay. You and I are both big fans of I hope everyone enjoyed that. That was a true moment between me and my friend Tim. Justice League International, we're big fans of that. Fast forward past the Giffen DeMatteis era into the later issues of Justice League Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just pull some of those artists and put them on this JSA. Same exact scripts, issues. Where do you fall?
All right. I was going to backtrack and answer that question more appropriately. And the fact that, unfortunately, this still is really hard because it also does boil down to the exact artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Does the exact artist, and also does the exact artist surprise us?
Yeah.
You know, I also even glanced at the issues that Parabek did for the 8-issue miniseries. Mm-hmm. They had a different inker. Not as good.
Well, he was still finding his iconic style at that point too, I think. Yeah.
I would have to say that without Parabek drawing it the way and having the inking and the whole talent team on this book as it is, no, I don't think it would have come together. I don't think it would have worked as well. And I think the same thing with the writer, is that if Len Straczynski had not been the writer of it, if someone else had come in, it might not have worked the same way. Mm-hmm. It might not have worked as well. I think his take on the characters and the way he told the story, really all of it clicked. All of it clicked together. If you take Parabek away, probably wouldn't be talking about it as much. But I also kind of feel like that you change anything about this formula, we might not have talked about it quite as much.
Yeah, fair. So I would say, keeping Len Straczynski on the book, same scripts, different artist, right? And again, I love a Tom Lyle, so that I'm an easy mark for that. I mean, I'm a pretty easy mark for Tom artist too, actually. But again, that's why I use the Justice League International Quarterly as a bit of a tease, because some of those later issues are really rough. And so,
just
like,
what
if the artist on these books were really rough? I think there's elements in here that would still stand out, because again, Straczynski's scripts are great with the way he's showed these people as senior citizens. He let them be old. They weren't just old people acting young. They didn't act just like their modern age counterparts. He let them be old. He built stories around them being older and the struggles that came with that. And he brought in this idea of legacy. So with the same scripts, with a different artist, I don't think it would be revered. I think there'd be elements we'd talk about. I think the idea of them being the elder statesman and mentoring the next generation would carry on to the next series. I think Jesse Quick might have made it out of here still into the flashbooks, because she was such a likable character. It's not just down to Parabek drawing her cute as a button. It's also, she was a good character. I think those elements would, but I don't think the series would have been revered. And I think you made a good point that I think that by the 10th issue, I think that Len Straczynski's scripts would have changed, because he was working to Parabek's strengths. He saw what he was getting, and he's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And he knew how to work to Parabek's strengths. And so if he had a less stellar artist, he may have been more wordy, or he may have had to try and find something that the artist could do well. Yeah. So I think, as you said, it's the melding, the perfect melding of the right art writer, the right artist, and it's what made the right element. Again, maybe every issue wasn't a success. Maybe there's stuff to pick apart. But overall, the right artist and the right writer made this book sing.
Yeah, I'm all on board with that. I do feel like that you also pulled out JL Quarterly, because it was also mentioned in the letters page here, for a JSA story that never got published in JL Quarterly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they say there's going to be an upcoming JSA-JLA team-up in Justice League Quarterly, right?
Yeah, they said it was going to be issue number 16, and I looked it up. That's the General Glory issue.
Right.
So, ooh.
Hmm.
And they also make a mention about some upcoming things happening in Eclipso, for the second generation Dr. Midnight and Wildcat, and it's like, why, you should not be talking about that.
That was not a good call. Choices were made, but hey,
choices were made. They're
both alive now, so
yes, we'll, they are.
Corrections were made as well.
Yes,
so there we go. all right, folks. So this is the moment where we have to nominate our favorite moment from the issue. This is going to be the All-Star Award. Now, it's whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that's made us laugh, whatever it is, both myself and Tim will pick only one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. Though, unless Tim is a complete fool, we're going to pick the same moment. So, what do you got, Tim?
I have never been accused of not being a fool. So, I'm afraid that of all the wonderful choices that you have to pick from in this issue, and there's a lot of them, I have to say it's page number 4 with Ted putting on his costume and flying up to face Kulak like a boss.
Okay. I
love that image. I know from your tone of voice that it's not the one you would have picked, and I'm pretty sure I know which one you picked, but I really, really like this.
That's a great page. I mean, I talked about it earlier. I talked about how stellar, pun intended, that page is with Ted flying out there. It's a total boss page. It looks phenomenal. We spent a lot of time talking about that page. So it is an absolute great one. I mean, it doesn't come even close to comparing to Kulak's eyeball popping out. But, okay, no, that is not what I picked. Folks, it's the last page of the book. I mean, come on. It is the heroes, as you said, around the Camelot, the round table. You know, he says, I called this meeting of the Justice Society to order the Justice Society of America. And the word balloon has their logo in it, and it also happens to be in the center of the table, as if the logo's in the center of the table. It for me, it's got to be that. Yeah, I'm not knocking your Starman pick. That's a heck of a great pick. I just had to pick for the iconic one that's sort of echoing All-Star Comics number 3, the one that started it all. So that's my pick. I absolutely adore it. And they're both great picks. They're both great pages. So, congratulations to both Starman being a boss and the team of reenacting All-Star Comics number 3. You both have earned the All-Star Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment. Now, Tim, I need to ask a favor. Kulak has left a mess behind in Gotham City as he manipulated the general public into hating the JSA. In fact, you know, if this had happened today in like 2025, I think Kulak would have used those typewriting social media monkeys like Lex Luthor had in the new Superman movie, which is what he would have been using. Regardless, would you mind helping clean up this mess left behind by Kulak's mind-controlled followers?
Oh, Lord. I do have my broom and dustpan right here. So, yeah, I'll be back in a couple hours.
Thank you, Tim. I do appreciate it. And yes, you're right. We will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I am going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
It's 1986. The Masters of Evil have a plan to crush the Avengers. They succeed. Can our heroes fight their way back to victory and defeat the Masters? Join me, Tim Price, and an assemblage of some of Earth's mightiest podcasters as we cover Avengers Under Siege, issue by issue, plus tie-ins, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the greatest Avengers story ever. The show, Outcasters Under Siege. Coming in 2026. Point your podcatcher to the Right On Network.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
Because you demanded it. It's Treasury Cast, a podcast devoted to the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. DC, Marvel, Archie, IDW, and more, bigger than life. It's the Treasury Cast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now remember, you can find us on social media as JSA Presents. As I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, I do have a request to make. If you don't mind, please go out to either iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever you want to call it, and please leave us a review. We do have quite a few reviews out there, but every additional review helps raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. So again, look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. As a thank you, I'll read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. All right, so now we're going to get into your comments left on our website and ones I could find on social media as well. I put it all into a Google document, and it is a lot of pages. So I'm just going to be cherry-picking bits and pieces of everyone's comments, but I want to make sure and acknowledge everyone. So this is going to be covering the previous episode where we discussed Justice Society of America number 9 with my guest Devin Clancy. First up is Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. Rob says, one interesting thing about Alan Scott is the post-Golden Age era, he's really good at using the ring, which makes sense as he's supposed to be Hal Jordan with more practice, but in the 1940s, he punched a lot of guys with a power ring. That is interesting, Rob. It seems like a lot of the Golden Age comics, they had the heroes punching, like even Dr. Fate, who had all this magic, went around punching people. So, then over Mike Weaver, who asked, will you be covering the Crisis Times 5 story arc in JLA number 28 through 31? Well, Mike, yes, we will. And as far as I'm concerned, that really is what kicks off the JSA in the 2000s era. Right, because there's that story, Crisis Times 5, which then leads to that little storyline, Justice Society Returns, which then leads into JSA number 1. So when this show that we're listening to right now, JSA in the 90s, becomes JSA in the 2000s, we're going to kick it off with that JLA storyline. So I think we're about a year away from getting to it or so. So it'll be somewhere in that range, Mike. So tune in. Then we're from Jeff R. You know, last episode, Dr. Midnight was listening to a radio news bulletin about a celebrity that had died. And we were speculating who that celebrity might have been. So Jeff R. did a little research, and he says probably the closest fit is Denholm Elliott, who played Marcus Brody in Indiana Jones. And he says, Indiana Jones counts as a superhero, right? The other details line up. It could be. The little commercial thing on the radio does say that he was a sidekick to a superhero, but in reality, yes, Marcus Brody was a sidekick to Indiana Jones. So I don't know. You might be onto something, Jeff. That could be who it was. Tim Price also, by the way, agreed with you. Then we're from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. Jose says, great episode. How funny is it that this issue is covered after the Superman movie where someone spews false propaganda turning the public against our heroes? Well, Guy Gardner gets involved. That is very oddly coincidental, Jose. Also, he mentions that we can now say that Guy Gardner is star of the big screen, which is just crazy, right? Then he says, as for my favorite moments when a hero meets their legacy, I have to go with the 1990 Starman. However, I'm going with the Starman 1 million issue where Ted Knight meets his descendant, Ferris Knight. Ted gets to see how far his legacy extends into the future, and while that starts off great, it quickly devolves with a confession by Ferris. This is a great example of how a hero's legacy might not always be a good thing. That's a great one, Jose. Then we heard from Devin Clancy, of course, who was the guest last episode. Says, thanks again to Shag for having me on. It was lots of fun. And there's things I forgot to mention in the episode. He says, another early exposure to the JSA was a book called Secret Origins of the Super DC Heroes. It was a paperback reprint from the mid-1970s that included the Golden Age and Silver Age origins of a ton of DC characters, including both Flashes, Green Lanterns, Hawk People, Green Arrows, and Atoms. I want to say I remembered included both Mahunkle and the Android Guy, but I could be wrong about that. And then Devin continues to say, for some reason, I carried the last days of the JSA comic around for a while and ended up tracing it or recreating it in art class very poorly. Then he says, on page 10, you see a TV image of Alan Scott shaking hands with a Soviet, but they're shaking left hands. As anyone who's heard Shag's V podcast episodes knows, that's a sure sign of brainwashing and trickery. You know, that comment, Devin, may have been just for me and no one else in the world gets it, but it made me very happy. Thank you, Devin. Then we heard from Al the Comics Guy, who says, interesting to note that even back then, Guy had already quite a few run-ins with a lot of his other fellow heroes by that point. Batman, Superman, Hal Jordan, etc. But none of them ever seemed as satisfying to me as when Alan Scott gave him his comeuppance. Way to hold it down for the elder crowd, Alan. Yeah, Al, it was a really great moment, wasn't it? Then we heard from Brett Miller, who says, my two favorite Green Lanterns on the cover. Of course I had to buy it. As for the question posed, I'm not sure if this counts, but there was an issue of a much underrated comic, Damage, where Alan Scott showed showed up to teach him self-control. He claimed to be an expert in willpower. I loved it. You know, Brett, I'm going to allow it, because even though the damage was, at least we all thought, was a legacy character of either Al Pratt or Human Bomb, if I remember right, by the time they got to the end of that series, they said he was like a concoction of the entire JSA. So really, Damage would be a legacy to the whole JSA, I think. So I think that works. Then we heard from Super Captain, who says, an angry mob of ordinary citizens attacking the JSA and is not caused by the Psycho Pirate? Now that's a twist. Then he goes on to say, Alan Scott has long been my favorite Green Lantern, although Jessica Cruz is gaining on him. Seeing him teach Guy Gardner a lesson is right up there with that moment between Batman and Guy in Justice League International. Yes, that moment. Thank you, Super Captain. And as far as heroes meeting their legacies, I can't decide between so many great moments between Jay and Wally during the 1990s Flash series. There are so many amazing moments, you're right, between Jay and Wally in that Flash run. So good. Then Sean Ross from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, he has a show called Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. He says, I'm so sad the series is coming to an abrupt end with the next issue. It would have been fun to see it get more runway to develop. I would have especially liked to have seen more members of the All-Star Squadron show up. Yeah, I really think, based on some of the hints they were dropping there, I think they're planning to do something at the very least with the young All-Stars, which have been an interesting, and Liberty Bell. And on a strange note, Devin has such a great voice for podcasting. As I was listening in the car, my wife asked if I was listening to NPR. Devin missed his calling as the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Sean could not agree more. I told Devin right as we started recording that pretty much I hated him for having a voice that great. So, then we heard from Hal, who says, I'm not surprised almost nobody knows who Kulak is. He only made one Golden Age appearance. I wouldn't have known who he was either if Roy Thomas hadn't brought him back for All-Star Squadron. I guess that was enough for him to get a listing in Who's Who. I have a copy of Mayfair's World at War sourcebook. I agree with Shag. It's well worth it if you want to take a deep dive into DC's war characters. It gets very deep into the lore. Well, Hal, I'm glad you like that World of War sourcebook. And folks, hang on just a few more minutes to hear a little more about the World at War sourcebook and why it might be of interest to you. Then John Stive is always kind enough to help promote the show, and he says, long before Guy Gardner was a big-time movie and TV star, he was a lovably obnoxious Green Lantern who could be decked with a a single punch by Batman. Check out the latest JSA in the 90s podcast to see him clash with Alan Scott, the original Green Lantern. Thanks, John. Then we heard from Chris Franklin from the Firewater Podcast Network. Him and his wife do a show called Mr. and Mrs. Superman right here on the JSA Presents feed. They also do the House of Frankenstein and a whole bunch more. Chris says, Alan Scott taking out Guy Gardner with one punch was brilliant. Oh, and Shag, when reading feedback, I think you do have to use the sound effect for my post, because I was the guy on that original JLI podcast episode that covered the classic one punch issue. Fine, Chris, just for you, only for you, because yes, you were on that particular Justice League International episode. Fine, fine, but that's it, no more! Then Chris continues saying, legacy heroes meeting their mentors. I know it's a bit past the 90s, but in that last arc of Starman, when Jack went to the past and teamed up with a younger version of his dad and David as the Starman of 1951, that was a wonderful bow around the whole series. Outside of that decade, I love the DC Comics Presents annual number one story with the two Superman. I plan to cover it on the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories here at some point. Awesome, Chris. Can't wait to hear your coverage on that. Then we heard from, I don't know who this guy is, some weirdo named Tim Price. Never heard of him. Apparently he has a podcast called The Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and a Batgirl Hunters podcast. No idea. No clue who this guy is. Anyway, he says, looking at the cover, I can see the inking of Mike Macklin, but also when I study Guy's face, I swear that's Carl Kessel's inks. That would explain Guy looking less cartoony than usual for Parabak. So maybe Macklin was channeling Kiesel's style for Guy specifically, or maybe Kiesel did ink the cover for a one-time thing. I can't see any artist signatures on the cover, so it could be either way. That's an interesting observation. You know, there are times, certainly, when other inkers step in and help out, or redraw a face when needed, so yeah, you might be right. For the biker that barges into McNider's clinic and refuses to help him, I don't know if this was discussed, but the biker has the Eye of Kulak mark on his forearm, shown on page 5. Since the eye was also prominent in the previous issue, I inferred that the spell influenced people with Kulak's mark even stronger, so the biker reacted to Charles as Dr. Midnight, while not knowing why. See, Joan also not knowing why she was mad at Jay. Yeah, Tim, I mean, that sort of tracks with what we talked about today as well, as far as, you know, people with the eye seem to know who the Justice Society are, and then I think after the eye passes that they forget who it was, so. And then Tim says, I feel like a broken record, but for the Golden Age successor team-ups, Mark Waid did a couple of my favorites with the series Faster Friends, featuring Jay and Alan working with Wally and Kyle, and later in his Brave and the Bold Flash Green Lantern miniseries. Issue number 5 had Jay and Alan with Barry and Hal. Both are stellar, but I'm an easy mark with Mark Waid's writing. absolutely. Mark Waid writing The Flash has got my dollar every time. So totally understand, Tim. Then we heard from Dave Tomko, who runs the website New Earth 2. Dave says, another great episode and another great issue. I love that cover. I'm a total sucker for Alan Scott facing off against a legacy Green Lantern. We've had plenty of Kyle and Hal fighting Alan, but this is the only cover with Al versus Guy. Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about that. And Dave says, I also agree that when it comes to legacy stories, Starman is the strongest, but that time travel arc from JSA number 68 through 72 was also great. And I couldn't help but wonder if the Hourman series mentioned in the letter column was the same one Paul Jenkins talked about recently. He pitched it to DC Comics, but they passed. He reworked the concept into the Sentry over at Marvel. And then Dave included the link over on his New Earth 2 website. Holy moly. Could you imagine the different world we would have lived in if Paul Jenkins' Hourman series that became Sentry had ended up at DC? I mean, Sentry would become, you know, he's part of the Thunderbolts movie. That would have been a huge to-do. Anyway, for more, again, visit newearth2.com. Then we hear from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, I think there's only one older hero Guy will listen to, his childhood hero, General Glory. You're probably right on that, Bucky. Then Bucky poses a question about what would be a great retcon for the JSA. What if General Glory and Ernie had a story where they were leading their own version of the Invaders with TNT, Dan the Dynamite, and Johnny Thunder and his Thunderbolt? That would have been interesting, Bucky. Bucky also poses who would have like written and drawn it, but I don't know my Golden Age writers and artists very well, so I don't know. But I tell you, Roy Thomas probably would enjoy doing it. But good thought, Bucky. Thanks. Then we're from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, y'all are correct, and Nathan Fillion was great as Guy Gardner in the Superman movie. Then Liz goes on to say, also interesting is now that Alan Scott is the only one of these heroes from this comic not to appear in live action. Wow, I hadn't thought about that. Now, I do have a small correction for you, Liz, is that there was a live action Alan Scott who had a cameo in Smallville and then a really brief cameo in the opening episode of Stargirl. So those were live action, but they weren't really significant parts. But you're right, though. We've seen live action versions of a lot of other characters in significant roles. We've seen Guy Gardner, Hourman, Dr. Midnight, Jay Garrick, Wildcat, Starman, Hawkman. I mean, lots of these characters have appeared in live action and Alan hasn't had a significant role. Yeah, we're due, right? We need to see Alan Scott. Let's see it. Come on. Come on, DC. Come on, James Gunn. Give it to us. Then we're from J. David Weider, formerly of the Dave's Daredevil podcast. Well, really, Dave's got a lot of podcasts under his belt, but that Daredevil podcast is one of my all-time favorites. Anyway, Dave said, audio comfort food from Shag and the JSA. Aww. Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. Then we heard from James Williams, says, Devin's podcast suggestions at the end of the episode had me laughing out loud. I think I laughed the hardest at the Who's Who review. It was funny, and there actually is a podcast that has a segment where they review their own reviews. I'd actually listened to a Tangent Comics podcast because the host going off on tangents is often my favorite part of the podcast. And Devin chimed back in and says, turns out it's really easy to come up with terrible podcast ideas. Now, I don't know if Devin's just being funny or if that's a dig at me, Devin. And then we hear from Grumpy Old John. Yeah, that is what he goes by, Grumpy Old John. He says, I have to agree with the JSA Presents and several friends who told me how awesome the Justice Society of America series was and ended way too early. I've got 3 more issues and I'll be done. Yes, I know it doesn't seem like I'm a fast reader, but I've been spacing them out so I can enjoy them more. Well, hope you get to enjoy those final issues, Grumpy Old John. Then Lito Sandoval says, another great episode. Regarding the Dr. Midnight scene, I did read that as the nurse was his partner. Nurses typically don't call doctors by their first name. Great catch, Lito. Good point. Dr. Midnight hooking up with his nurse. Pretty interesting. Then we heard from Robert Junker, who says, you were asking about team-ups with legacy characters. My favorite meetup was with Jesse Quick and the Black Lantern Johnny Quick. They had a heart-to-heart in the Blackest Night event. And if I recall, now it's been a while, but it was the last time she wore the Liberty Bell costume and went back to being Jesse Quick. Interesting, Robert. I don't remember that at all. I mean, I read it. I read the whole Blackest Night event and all the crossovers. I have completely forgotten about that. I'm going to have to go check that out. Thank you so much. Then over on Patreon, I asked the folks there, too, what was their favorite team-up between JSAers and their legacies. Got some good answers. Mark Balbus says, Green Lantern number 40 from October 1965 is my all-time favorite comic. Best cover ever. My wife patterned and cross-stitched the cover for me. It hangs at the top of our stairs. Wow, Mark, that's really cool. Then we heard from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says there was plenty of times in Mark Waid's run where there would be all the speedsters. But I liked it when they got Jay and Wally and Johnny Quick and Jesse all running around fighting. Probably Terminal Velocity is the best example. Right there with you, Dr. Ange, on those Flash appearances, without a doubt. Then we heard from Simon Pierre Desmarais. I apologize if I slaughtered your last name, Simon. He says, the Brave and the Bold miniseries has a team up with the Flashes, Jay and Barry, and the Green Lanterns, Alan Hal, and an apparition of Wally West as Kid Lantern. Wow. That sounds fun. Then we heard from M.A. Salko from the podcast Kids in America, a Molly Pitcher and Betsy Ross podcast. Salko says, one of my favorite legacy crossover stories happened in Wonder Woman number 300. Much of the story is Wonder Woman dealing with imaginary scenarios while fighting a nightmare demon. She's questioning her relationship with Steve Trevor, and a sideways step to Earth 2 sees her meeting the Earth 2 Diana, married to Steve and with a daughter named Lyta, written by Roy and Dan Thomas. It was a genuinely nice moment, and I hope no multiversal catastrophes come along in the following few years. Well, thank you, Salko. Then we heard from Stephen E. Shend, who's a role-playing game designer extraordinaire. He actually owns an original page from Justice Society of America number 8 by Mike Parabak. In fact, me and my guest, Dave Steele, we were just gushing over this page. It's this phenomenal page where Hourman and Johnny Quick are fighting side by side, and Hourman grabs Johnny Quick by the feet and spins him around while Johnny punches the super speed. It's this amazing page, and Stephen E. Shend happens to own the original page, which is incredible. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. And he has the promo poster for this series, the Justice Society of America promo poster by Mike Parabak. He has that poster signed by both Mike Parabak and Len Strzuski. Wow, those are some seriously cool things, Stephen. Thank you for sharing those with us over on Blue Sky. All right, folks, speaking of that, this is where we thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline. So we're talking about Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. Now, I know this is a long list of names. I totally get that, folks. However, these folks helped support the show and promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize each one of these individuals. For example, this is the only time Codex Omniversa is going to get mentioned, but they're part of our family and they deserve to be recognized. And this time out, we've got nearly 80 names of people who helped promote the show recently. So you could be on this list next episode. It's very easy, just by sharing or retweeting or skeeting or whatever the hell it's called on all those other platforms. Again, Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, or Threads. So our thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Freitas, Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer and his The Bat Pod account, Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brett Young, Chelsea Daniel, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chris Mort, Clinton Robinson in the Coffee and Comics blog, Codex Omniversa, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, David Ace Gutierrez, Derek Crabb, Devin Clancy, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Earth 2 Podcast, Extremely Uncanny, Gentleman Joey, Grumpy Old John, J. David Weeder, Jamerson A. Tiasi, James Santana, John 77121149, John McNamara, John Stibe, Jordan Jennings, J.P. Rocha, Justin Steiner, Kara Lovett, Keechy Baker, Lizanne Oswald, Marcus Sorois, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matthew Barton, Max Romero, Michael Kramer, Mike Jameson and his Pop Culture Basement Podcast, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, New Earth 2, Orange Chevelle, Paul Kean, Paul Wildenberger, Pedro Angosto, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, S. Matthew Stolte, Scarlet Bordeaux Fan, Scott X, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Symbol Pending, Teal Productions, the only Captain Britain fan, Tim Price and his Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Trent Lewis, Venkman, Watch This Space, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew, wow. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show. I always say that, and I absolutely mean it. And this community of JSA fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Devin Clancy from last episode. Now, I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So if I miss you, just let me know. And please keep those cards and letters coming. The best way to be part of the conversation is on our website. So go to fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and we can communicate together. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents. Again, Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. Or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you folks for providing such a fantastic collection of feedback. Seriously, it just brings me so much joy to go through this every single month. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Tim Price, and see if he had any luck cleaning up after Kulak.
Two months only, Halloween Hoedown at the house of Frankenstein.
Your favorite Halloween party returns with four brand new episodes featuring cinematic horror classics and horror-filled superhero tales starring Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man.
Pin the bandage on Boris Karloff as the mummy.
You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime and death.
Do The Locomotion with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing on the Horror Express.
Are you telling me that an ape that lived 2 million years ago got up to that crate, killed the baggage man and put him in there?
Yes, I am. It's alive. It must be.
Bob for Apples with Hammer's The Reptile.
Get away from there! Get away!
Jam to the blues at this juke joint full of sinners.
We gonna kill every last one of you.
This September and October, join the Supermates at FireAndWaterPodcast.com for the most happening haunt this side of the mausoleum, the House of Frankenstein. Halloween Hoedown!
Who's editing? A thought experiment in which Siskoid and his guest appoint themselves editors of a comic book line at DC Comics. But the joke's on them, because they can only use the characters of a specific issue of Who's Who, and in fact must use them. Great ideas? Yes, we think so. Cool reinventions? Of course. Crisis fatigue? We guarantee it. Who's Editing? Now on its own feed, only at the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Tim back with us. First, Tim, thank you so much for appearing on this episode. I knew I was going to have you in one of these Paraback episodes, and once I started looking at the calendar and realized that issue 10 was the right place for you. So, would you please tell the listeners where they can find you on the interwebs?
I'd be glad to. You can find me on social medias as TimPrice17, whether it be Blue Sky or Threads or Instagram or Discord or other things. I mean, skywriting, maybe that works too. Just TimPrice17. And you also can find me on my podcast, The Outcasters, which is on the Right On Network. It's a WRIGHT. I spell it because one of my kids had trouble finding it because they kept using the other ways to spell the word right. So it is WRIGHT on network. And yes, it's The Outcasters, where we are covering the Batman and the Outsiders era of comics. And we are very close to reaching the conclusion of the Baxter series. And after that, we'll be launching the new era of the Outcasters, where I'm going to be covering other series of stories that I enjoyed. And the first one will be the Avengers Under Siege storyline. Yeah, I'm very excited about that for 2026. Is that right? 2026? That can't be right.
It's around the corner, man.
Oh, for pity's sake. I am feeling my JSA right now. So, that is just coming up very soon, and I'm very excited about this new era of the Outcasters. So yeah, you can find me there. You also can find me on Right On Network on our Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast, where AJ and I cover issues featuring our favorite Batgirl Cassandra Cain. And one last time, Shag, thank you so much, one, for doing this series and covering it so well, because this is one of my favorite series, period, of all time. And you've done such a great job and had such great guest hosts on for it to discuss each issue. And it's just been a joy from beginning to end. So thank you. And thank you for having me on.
Oh, well, it was an absolute pleasure. And thank you for the kind words. It's down to the guests, and it's down to the incredible book by Straczynski and Paraback and Macklin. That's what it's down to. So it's a favorite of mine, and the can't help but the love pouring through the microphone. It's so good. So, and again, mm-hmm. I loved having you on the show, Tim. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, man.
All right, folks. Now that's going to do it. Now come back next episode when we're going to take a bit of a sidestep. Now, since we have just finished up this volume of Justice Society of America, before jumping into that 1991 miniseries we've been talking about, we are going to take a couple of spotlight episodes. So next month's episode, in keeping with our mandate of JSA content published in the 1990s, we're going to be looking at a role-playing book source book published in 1991. It's from Mayfair Games for the DC Heroes RPG, and it's called The World at War. It's a massive 128-page role-playing sourcebook covering all of the World War II characters. We're talking Sergeant Rock, the Haunted Tank, the Blackhawks, the Unknown Soldier, the Freedom Fighters, plus it is chock-a-block full of details on the JSA and related characters, like the entire All-Star Squadron's in there, the Young All-Stars, obviously the JSA, so much more. And the cool thing is it's all the character stats and histories. It's written as they appeared in the Golden Age. So it's not like saying, you know, here they were in 44, 1994, and here they are in, you know, 1990. No, it's all written in that golden age mode where they're young, and it's showing you them at the height of their powers. It's really cool. It's a fascinating peek into that post-crisis DC universe and how they perceive World War II for heroes. You know, it's really cool. And given the theme of, you know, the world at war and our military, we'll be releasing this episode on November 11th, on Veterans Day. That's as it's called here in the U.S. If you're outside the U.S., you might know it as Armistice Day or Remembrance Day. If you're the kind of person that grabs the episode the minute it drops, just know that's going to be on a Tuesday rather than a Sunday because of Veterans Day. Now, for that episode, of course, I'm going to be joined by a fantastic guest. And who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Or, if you've ever listened to any of my previous episodes about role-playing, you can probably guess who my guest is going to be. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Tim.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.